Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome aboard. Halfway to Friday. Middle of the week. Hump day. Oh, but you know, brothers and sisters, you know it's so much more than that. It's not just any old middle of the week. No, sir. This is a special, the special day in the midst of the hectic work week, when we pause, relax, and reflect. Yea, verily, brethren and sistren, it's prayer meeting. Choir master.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen.
Amen.
Let me hear you say, Praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah!
Hallelujah!
Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stop the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD. Just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of moolah. Solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity.
Paid for by Bush Cheney 04.
Oh, this is going to be a weird night. I've got, Internet Explorer just going bat crazy. It's crashed a couple of times, and there goes the cart deck firing itself. Oh dear. We better get busy and pray, brothers and sisters, because it is prayer meeting, and that's what this is all about. Come on down the blood red carpet to the altar here in the Cathedral of Common Sense and lay your hands upon the subwoofer and feel the healing rays of rationality flowing through your body. How? Yes! I am Archbishop Bob Kincaid, and I'm beginning to think that this here computer is needing some hands laid upon it. You know, I don't know, maybe we better put a shrine to the possum goddess up by the shrine to reason and common sense. Brother. So I got a bunch of things to go into this evening, not the least of which is Pat Boone. You heard a good bit of that via Mark Levine in the previous hour, and everything he said is true. The story is real. But as always, there is a story that hides behind the story. in this particular instance, you know, the news story from the right wing garbage site that had this opinion piece. It said Pat Boone has sold more records than anyone except Elvis. By what measure? You honestly want me to believe that Pat Boone has sold more records than the Beatles? The Stones? Britney Spears? Michael Jackson? With this stuff? I mean, really, with this? Man.
On a day like today, we pass the time away.
And we're not gay.
Writing love letters in the sand.
That aren't man to man.
How you laughed when I cried. Each time I saw the tide take our love.
Backward skate.
You made a vow that you would ever be true, but somehow that vow meant nothing to you. Now my broken heart aches with every wave that breaks over love letters in the sand.
Man to man. Man, you just don't get whistling like that every day, do you? As long as none of those love letters are the letters G, A, or Y. Yeah. Pat Boone is so straight, he can't even write the letters C, D, G, J, O, P, Q, R, S. That probably explains the bizarre ravings inside that weird right-wing editorial that he wrote. Oh, Pat Boone. They couldn't you go back to hustling, I don't know, acne statin? I mean, haven't you screwed up enough people's lives? I mean, after all, you didn't do so well with your daughter. Just makes you want to put the polyester on, doesn't it?
To sing me his song. So many dreams I kept deep inside me.
Alone. Wonder what kind of dreams, Debbie?
In the dark.
Alone in the dark?
But now you've come along. And you
what kind of carrying on do you want to do, Debbie? We got carrying on and filling going on. Oh, with song. Yeah, okay. Rolling at sea. drifting. Oh, dear. We got all kinds of sick imagery here. What did you do to that child, Pat Boone? What did you do? Nah, I'm sorry. I can't even do that to you. That's all. Enough. Lighting up? In the dark? Carrying on? What a twisted bunch these Boons are. And, of course, the introduction to the editorial notes that a direct, Pat Boone, this direct descendant of Daniel Boone. Well, let me see. Let me see if I've got this straight. Pat Boone wants to persecute gay people, and Daniel Boone was pretty damn good at persecuting Indian people. So, yeah, I guess like great-great-great-multi-great-grandpa like multi-great-grandson, right? Okay. There's more. There's really, really more. But we will go first to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hey, Susan.
You're bound and determined to wreck up my hearing, aren't you?
I am. I brought up a whole bunch of dinners in the last 5 minutes, too.
Mine among them. Oh, my word. Yeah.
Oh, but there's more. I mean, don't put the Rolaids away.
Can I interject a little something?
You can interject a lot of something if you want.
Well, I want to tell you a story, a modern fable.
Okay.
Okay. Last week, our furnace died. Now, this was the furnace that I spent my inheritance on in cash to buy.
This doesn't sound like a fable. Fables are like made-up stuff. This sounds smacking way too much of reality.
Oh, yeah, it did. And so hubby and I spent and I called up the people who installed it, and the guy informed me. This thing's out of warranty. And besides that, we dropped the brand. By the way, if you're ever thinking about buying a Lennox furnace, don't. And I said, oh. And I hung up.
Yeah.
After I explained to the guy that, hey, there was no way we could pay for them to come out and repair the furnace. So on and so forth. Well, later, we get a phone call, and it's the owner of the company. He wants to know, are we going to be home tomorrow between 10 and 1?
Mm-hmm.
I go, yeah. Why? He says, I want to come out and look at your furnace. And I said, we can't afford to pay you. He says, I understand that. I'm going to do it anyway. And I'm saying, thank you. I figured, at the very least, he'll tell me it's dead and we'll go from there. So he comes out and he looks at it and he says, it turned out to be one of the major circuit boards that actually fired up the furnace,
mm-hmm.
Which is about a $400 part.
Ouch.
He says, yeah. And he says, I'm going to go back and check because this might still be under warranty. And we said, okay, thank you. And then, hubby and I, we went back with our oven and, our blankies and shivered. Guy came out today with a helper with a new board, installed it, fixed our furnace. Thank you. Have a nice day. Wandered off.
Wow.
He ate over $300. It turned out it wasn't under warranty. But you see, this guy, and he is the owner of the East Side Heating Company in Portland, Oregon. People in Portland, if you need furnace help, I suggest you patronize this man.
Yep. Do right by folks who know what it means to do right.
Exactly. He drove all the way from Portland on his own dime, fixed this furnace on his own dime. And didn't ask for a dime.
That's wonderful.
And I figured since today's Wednesday, sure we should not, take it to the right-wing religion industry, but we should also say thank you as well.
Yeah. Thank you to the human being who exhibited such profoundly human decency.
Exactly. And I told him, hey, do you know what Internet Talk Radio is?
Oh, dear.
No. And I said, you're about to find out. And then I told him what I did in my spare time when I could actually get up the stairs. And so don't be surprised if, I told him, don't be surprised if you don't start hearing from people like from in Germany and stuff like that saying, hey, you did nice.
That was very, very good.
Because if nothing else, this guy deserves to be thanked.
Yeah, he does.
Because I don't know who else he's done this for.
And, it's... Yeah, you apparently you didn't militate, you didn't write nasty letters to the company or anything like that. This was just the somebody doing the right thing.
Yeah, he did the right thing for the right reason, and for that, hey, I'm gonna spread him and his company all over the internet.
And you know what? He could spend thousands and thousands of dollars advertising, but he couldn't buy that kind of good reputation.
Exactly.
You cannot pay. You cannot pay for mouth for word of mouth. And frankly, it's part and parcel of the success that we've had. You know, we don't have a bunch of bucks to go passing around advertising on sites and, as much as I'd like to, but there are a bunch of sites I'd love to put horn advertisements on, but shoot, we can't do that. It's enough just keeping the lights on. But
yeah.
The word of mouth of people going to places, like morningconstitution.com or Democratic Underground or blogging on any of the various and sundry blogs and other bloggers who are our friends who pass the word about what's going on here. We can't buy that. We couldn't afford it. If we were filthy rich, we couldn't afford it. You cannot pay for good reputation.
Yeah, and this is the upside of the American, okay, upside of American commerce, the good side of it. Okay, the downside of it are things like Wall Street, investment bankers demanding $10 million bonuses when their companies were being bailed out by the taxpayer. But this is the upside because these guys are supporting their product even when they don't really have a legal need to do so. But they're supporting the customer base because they know sooner or later, I might just need another furnace. And you can bet your bippy, if I have anything to say about it, that's the company we're going to.
Sure. You'd be crazy not to.
Yeah. And that's why I'm going to be going all over the internet, all over these blogs, and I'm going to start. Even the concern, I'm even going to do the ultimate. I'm going to brave the Daily Kos. And I'm going to put this up on there. I'm going to tell them, hey, I don't do this. But this needs to be told.
Yeah. And I'm sure there are some local blogs there in the Portland area, Susan, that would be great places for you to put a good word. Most newspapers and so forth maintain a blog presence that would be where folks would actually be able to be receptive to and appreciative of.
Oh, yeah, I'm way ahead of you. But I also want this out all over the place. That's why I'm calling you, because this is the first step, because this guy did good. And he didn't have to, but he did good. And I thank him. So I'm going to do my best to thank him.
And the name of the company again?
Eastside Heating. It's in Portland.
Great. Wonderful. And I'm proud. This, you know, that while y'all don't necessarily get the really really vile stuff, it gets cold enough to be icky during the winter, and you don't need a busted furnace this time of year.
Yeah, 67 degrees is not fun when you, especially when you have COPD.
Well, yeah, frankly, when I think about the service that your husband rendered in how many wars? World War II in Korea, it was really, really the right thing to do.
Yep. So, anyway, I just thought I would call in and let everybody know, hey, this is something nice, and as bad as the economy is, and as bad as some of the, as scummy as some of the politics are turning out to be, hey, it's nice to hear a good story. And my next call tomorrow will be to the local television station.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very good. Susan, have a wonderful, warm evening.
Oh, I plan on I'm going to get all nice and toasty warm.
Okie doke. Wonderful. And say good evening to Donald for us, please.
Yeah, I'll do that and give my love to Agnes.
Sure will. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. And we'll roll on back to the phones in a minute. By the way, if you don't know the phone number, if you're new to the program, 877-443-2366. That's 877, the numeral 4, head on. Or locally, if you want to save us the cost of the toll charges, 304-658-3333. Reverbo, our critic at large, chimes in early and says, stop the madness, Bob. Pat Boone night on prayer meeting Wednesday will not increase listenership like Beatles night did. And you know what? It's true, Reverbo, and I gotta say I'm glad of that. I'm not trying to run anybody off, but by the same token, if we were getting more listeners because we were playing Pat Boone, I'd wonder about who we were reaching. Jay chimes in and just a few facts for about Pat Boone for you. He grew up in the Church of Christ and went to Lipscomb College. Now, this is not the United Churches of Christ. This is the other Church of Christ that practically owned my hometown. And that's the thing. That's why I really didn't understand until I got out of my hometown what a little fundy I was. Because the Church of Christ was so weird, they thought of Baptists as the liberals, okay? Pat Boone grew up in the Church of Christ and went to Lipscomb College, a Church of Christ school in Nashville, Tennessee. And, yeah, Jay, we've discussed the folks in the Church of Christ before, and I think I just did it again. He's preaching to the choir, but it's a very small choir, says Jay. Thanks, Jay. And don't think you've gotten past it. Don't push me. Don't push me. I have more Pat Boone. I've got more Pat Boone than you'd like to know that I've got. And don't think that I won't pull this radio show over and use it. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hey.
Yeah, this is Larry.
Yeah, Larry, how are you?
Okay, down here in Florida. It's been a nice day today. I don't know how it is up there. I heard that you had bad weather that way.
We had a bunch of wind blow through, and it's just been kind of icky and gray all day long.
Oh, it's too bad.
But if it's not, there's something wrong here if this time of year you're not getting some icky and gray.
Right. You make up for it in the fall when you get the leaves and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Old Pat Boone, I don't know. Is he irrelevant? You know, we actually know somebody that went to school with him at Lipscomb.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Lipscomb's one of those schools. I don't know if you need a double-digit ACT to get in there or not. I remember them advertising on the radio for students in September.
In September?
Yeah.
That's like school's already started.
I know.
Well, yeah, there's a couple of them there in Tennessee. There's Lipscomb, and then there's, oh, yeah, okay, what's the other? Freed Hardeman over there in southwestern Tennessee, and those people are a bunch of freaks.
Yeah, I think Freed Hardeman is probably the conservative branch. Lipscomb's the liberal branch, I guess, in town.
Yeah, it's. I think Freed Hardeman is like the. I don't know. Maybe it's the Notre Dame of Church of Christness.
Yeah, well, unless you consider, what is it, Harding down in Arkansas.
Ooh, forgot about that. They do get around, don't they? And not a piano in none of them.
Right. And, you know, we've talked to people like one of them was a prominent lawyer in town. And he admitted, yeah, what you have to do is you go there for a couple of years to get your ticket punched, and then you can go to a real school.
And so, or you can, I mean, you can almost get out and go into the preaching racket, can't you?
Oh, yeah, but, you know, if you really aren't that dumb, I mean, you might want a real career.
That's true, but, you know, it depends on what you're after, Larry. I mean, the guys who go into the Church of Christ preaching racket do pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, they're in my hometown where I grew up in Alabama. These things, they built the huge, huge churches and, you know, hand over fist money raising. And the local Church of Christ preachers are like local celebrities. It's positively medieval, frankly.
If you want to get ahead in business in town, why, that's where you have to show up on Sundays.
Darn right. Exactly. And, you know, I remember there was always a race. This is so hypocritical, but so typical. There was a race between the preachers to see who could get their congregations out the door fast enough to get into line first at Morrison's cafeteria.
Because
that's where, if you were a fundy going out to Sunday dinner, that's where you went.
Yeah, well, there wasn't anything else to do. Especially over in the Shoals, I had friends over there, and they said there was absolutely nothing else to do on Sunday except eat out.
And they do with a vengeance.
Yeah, and I suppose it was only the heathens that worked in the restaurants cooking the stuff up, while the rest were doing whatever they do.
Well, exactly. And you know, some of us heathens would even cut church on some Sundays and get there at 11:30 and just sit and chuckle at all the others sitting in line. But, you know, there was hell to pay for that because they all knew that we'd cut.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
But you could kind of tell, Larry, which church had its associate pastor doing the sermon, which head pastor had taken the Sunday off, because that would be the 11:30 crowd. That's the associate pastor. We can take a miss on this one.
You know, what I wanted to call in about is it's that season again, you know? And I wanted to just exhort people to get out their King James and read the Christmas story. Read it in Matthew and then read it in Mark and then contemplate why they're so different.
And they really, really are, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. And it's not just, one guy was, telling it from a Roman standpoint and the other from a Hebrew standpoint. No, these are real factual differences that are incompatible.
They're like completely different stories of completely different births.
In Matthew, Mary and Joseph live in Bethlehem, and then they get visited by the wise men, and then they take off for Egypt because Herod's going to kill all the kids. And then a little later on, they get word from an angel that it's okay to come back, but the angel was misinformed, and they can't go to Bethlehem where they would have gone because that's where they were from. So they, they have to go to Nazareth. And the other, they have this thing where they have to go from Nazareth to Bethlehem because of a tax that history knows nothing about.
When Cyrenius was governor in Syria, wasn't that it?
Yeah, yeah. Which
And the Romans were impeccable record keepers. doesn't show up, does it?
Right. And then after that, they don't run off to Egypt after 40 days, which I guess was the purification time after having a baby because Mary would have been unclean.
Yeah, dirty, 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 filthy woman.
Yeah, but of course Catholics say she was never unclean. I mean, she was always a virgin and all that. So I don't understand that. But anyway, they didn't run off to Egypt. They went to Jerusalem and the temple and all that. So on the way home. Now, that doesn't make sense to me either.
You know, and I don't know. I can't think right offhand, Larry, where one would get one's hands on one of these. I used to have one when I was a religion student back in the bad old days of college. But I had a text called the Synoptic Gospels, you know, which is, of course, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Because John really doesn't count.
Yeah.
John just wasn't there. John's just making stuff up. He's just bogarting off the other three and probably Thomas and some that we don't know about. But what it did is it took the verses of each book and it laid them side by side. And so you could see where they agreed and see where folks were inserting things. And we did in that class, and I had so much respect for my professor. And it was one of those rarities because the guy was a hard, hardcore right winger, and he's dead now. And they lost a great professor when he was killed. But he was a marvelous professor, and he kept all of his politics out of the classroom and just approached religious texts with pure critical analysis techniques. And if I could have had that guy every semester in my college career, I would have been happy as a clam. But laying them side by side, you can see the flaws, you can see the inaccuracies, you can see where one was copying off the other, and you can see, as I noted, where people were just making stuff up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you can do that if you go to the used bookstore and buy two identical New Testaments. Usually they have a whole stack of them because some church gave them out one time, you know, free.
Right, right.
And then you can, with two of them, then you can paste them in a notebook side by side and go through them.
Well, you know, one of the things that I find handy, I have it here in front of me. In fact, I was going to use it later in the evening, Larry, but this is as good a time as any because you brought the topic up. See how prayer meeting works? Mark Levine was talking about radical fundamentalist cleric Mike Huxterby last night on The Daily Show, talking about how marriage had existed for 5,000 years and all that stuff. And it reminded me, because I've been geeking a little bit lately, I found my grandmother's aged, yellowed copy of something called the Jerusalem Bible.
Yeah.
And it's a fairly scholarly attempt at translating this madness. And the handy thing about it is it'll tell you right there in the middle of the page, and this is a different story of the same thing, which sort of immediately causes you to go, wait, this is the inerrant word of God. How's there a different version of the facts is facts? But anyway, I got to thinking about I was thinking the other night as I was plodding along through Genesis, because Genesis is just fascinating reading. And I was reading about the sanctity of marriage. And in fact, I was reading about it in Genesis chapter 34. Where Jacob, who has one daughter and 12 sons, Dinah is the daughter, and she went out to visit the women of Shechem. And Shechem is also the name of the son of Hamor the Hivite. You know Hamor, the two streets down from the Edomites. And he was ruler of that region. Shechem, this is the courtship ritual among ancient Palestinian people. And I'm quoting here. Shechem carried her off and raped her, and so dishonored her. But he was captivated by Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He fell in love with the young girl and comforted her. Accordingly, Shechem said to his father Hamor, "Get me this young girl. I want to marry her." Meanwhile, Jacob had heard how his daughter Dinah had been dishonored, but since his sons were out in the countryside with his livestock, Jacob said nothing until they came back. Courtship in 1300 BCE.
Yeah.
Well, there's your sanctity of marriage.
Yeah, she was required to marry her rapist.
Yeah, that's nice. But you know, like so many domestic abuse situations, Shechem rapes her, and then they have a courtship, and it happens to this day. You know, she calls the police on him for domestic violence. The police show up. You know, he's standing in his boxer shorts and his wife beater T-shirt, and she says, he didn't mean nothing by it, and he loves me, and he said he'll never, ever do it again. And she's standing there with half of her face all swollen up.
Yeah.
And I know cops, and the cops just say, you know, I hate getting these calls. I just hate getting these calls.
Yeah.
Because they said, you know, I know one of these days I'll go back and she'll be dead.
Well, I encourage people to read their Bible. You know, that is something that people just don't do.
Oh, absolutely, Larry. Reading the Bible is the biggest remedy to fundamentalism and organized religion that there is in this country.
Yeah. Yeah. I have run into ex-preachers who said, hey, there are more atheists in the pulpit than there are in the pews because they've read the Bible. And one friend of mine who was a preacher and got out of it, you know, managed to see the light and went into another field. And he said, as you know, for years afterwards, he had other preachers calling him, asking him, how did he manage to get out? Because they were desperate to stop doing what they were doing, but it was their livelihood.
I know, and it's a good livelihood. It is. It's a good living. You know, four or five generations back, I'm related to a circuit rider here in what was then Virginia, who literally could smell chicken frying from 50 miles away.
Yeah.
You don't have to do your own cooking. Somebody provides your house for you. You stand up and scream a little bit on Sunday, and you get paid for it. I mean, you can't argue with the racket itself.
Yeah, and if you're of such a mind, why is not only fried chicken, but you know, you're free during the day when all the guys are out working, and a lot of the women really get into religion, and you know, they're available.
Yes, they are, and so are tea times on the golf course. Because after all, everybody else is out working. You know, you can get a 10 a.m. tea time on a Tuesday afternoon on a beautiful spring day if you're a preacher, and it's you and God in the golf course.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing that stands that gets in the way of all this, Larry, is there's one thing that you cannot have if you're going to meet this job description. You cannot have 10 cents worth of scruples, and you've got to have less morality than a pit viper.
Right. Hey, did you hear that? I saw a story on the net that George W. Bush has said that, yeah, the Bible might not be literally true.
What? No, really?
Yeah, I saw that. I can email it to you if I find it again.
Oh, do please. Do please.
Yeah.
And I appreciated the presser from American Atheists as well about what to do about the holiday season.
Oh, yeah. Celebrate.
Yeah. Have a blast.
Right.
Because there's a reason that there are all kinds of religious holidays around this time of year, and most of them centered on lights or greenness or rebirth. I mean, yeah, the birth of the everlasting at the winter solstice. I guess the fundies are the only ones that this is lost on, Larry.
Yeah, well, a lot is lost on them. And it's really a shame. Can you imagine living a life like that? What kind of a world is it that they want to live in?
It's a world they hate. You know, I was watching a little bit of things were kind of quiet in the living room last night after the show was over, And I guess it's pledge drive marathon time on my local public TV channel. And they were running this documentary called From Jesus to Christ. And it was utterly fascinating. I was just sitting there watching it for about an hour, and I realized that just about everything I had ever been taught from a fundamentalist standpoint about Jesus was wrong. You know, not ideologically or subjectively wrong, but objectively wrong, as in nobody in their right mind could think that.
Does anybody remember that he's quoted as saying, sell all you have and give to the poor?
Yeah, that is there.
Yeah.
That's there about two verses before the disciples start squabbling among themselves about who's going to sit at his right hand, and he answers with beautiful, straight out of the Poconos comedic irony, you all get a crown, all right? You're all getting a crown, and you're all sitting right here next to me. You happy now? But they didn't get it. One of the things that was pointed out, just as fundies today hate the world they live in, and that's why they're all the time, waving their donations in the air like the song says and hollering, come Lord Jesus, come Lord Jesus. The early sect did too. And after Yeshua's crucifixion, they were all sort of sitting there left looking at each other. Okay, world's ending. He said there wouldn't be one stone left standing on the other. Anybody? Bueller? 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 And then they didn't, and so they had to, even then, they had to reinvent it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's been reinvented a lot of times. And that's why, he really didn't like music, I guess, because that's why the Church of Christ doesn't
sing and make melody in thy heart.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard one guy on the radio telling, why they believed. And it said, the Bible says lift up your voices. It doesn't say your fiddles and your organs and your pianos, only your voices, because it just says lift up your voices.
Yeah, no tambourines. Tambourines are out. Not so much as a castanet.
Yeah, and I thought, well, if you're to lift up your voice and nothing else, if the Bible says wear a hat to church, does that mean a hat and nothing else?
Oh, that's a beautiful thought. That is just beautiful.
I actually got a letter on World Net Daily. Somebody was trying to justify or argue against gun control on the basis of, Peter with a sword.
Yes.
Jesus said, go get a sword. Well, actually, he said, sell your cloak and buy a sword. But if you look, when they set out on their mission, he told them to only bring one cloak. So if they sold their cloaks, they would have been armed but naked.
Exactly, and all of that is within, and maybe it's cultural, Larry. All of that is within the rabbinical teaching tradition. You know, there's a lot of stuff that Jesus said that Hillel had said a couple of hundred years before.
Well, yeah, the people that wrote it were familiar with that.
A little bit, yeah, you would assume. And so to be carrying around a sword but not be protected from the elements points out the stupidity of violence.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little bit like what I was talking about last night about how I think it was a conversation with Preston, how the coal industry, which is, by the way, out there with, as Guy James mentioned earlier today, out there with their own little Christmas carols about coal now. The fundamentalists have got to be just absolutely beside themselves over this. The American coal bunch people with clean coal have replaced Christ in Christmas carols with lumps of coal. No kidding.
Well, Bob, are you going to get a lump of coal in your Christmas stocking?
Oh, I get one every blessed day.
Oh.
We breathe it, we eat it, we drink it, we roll in it. In a place like West Virginia, Larry, you really can't get away from it.
Yeah.
So it's like we've been bad 365 days of the year, because we get nothing but coal.
But if you want a job, that's probably where you have to go.
Well, actually, no, because even the Coal Association admits that there's only less than 5,000 mountain removers in this state. But that's what they admit privately. Their public face is that coal keeps the lights on in West Virginia and China. Well, okay, they leave out the China part.
Oh.
Coal keeps the lights on in West Virginia's funeral homes. No, it's not that. Coal keeps the lights on. But the fact of the matter is the coal economy employs next to no one. There's less than 15, even counting the good men and women of the UMWA, 15,000 miners in this state, when in 1980 there were 100,000. That's what mountain removal does, because all it takes is a skeleton crew using the same explosives that Timothy McVeigh used to blow up the Murrah Federal Building to blow up mountains that are millions of years old. That's all it takes. Few little domestic terrorists.
Have they completely taken over from the people, you know, the deep mine miners?
Not completely. About 40% of the coal coming out of West Virginia is mountain removal coal. And people like Massey Energy have done everything, and Don Blankenstein and the rest of that, or Blankenship, and the rest of that crowd have done everything they can to squeeze the life out of the UMWA.
Yeah.
So they haven't taken over entirely, but it's close enough for government work, as the saying goes. But it's that same kind of thing we were in this conversation about. And so they holler, the Coal Association hollers, well, if we don't have coal, you can't have no electricity. Well, if we do have coal, we can't have no clean water. Now, you can, and it's like Jesus telling him, you know, sell your cloak and buy a sword. You can live without a sword. You can't live without a cloak.
Yeah.
And you can live without electricity, but you cannot live without clean water. And in both instances, I think it's very ironic that most people miss that message. Well, he told him to go get a sword. That means violence is okay sometimes. No, it means that if, but, you know, I'm telling you. But, you know, it's not surprising because at the start of the George Bush's rape of the people of Iraq, the Southern Baptists, you know, if you remember, and you know, it's worthwhile that we remember this stuff, Larry, because it's easily forgotten because it exists in such volume. But at the beginning of the rape of Iraq, even George Bush's United Methodist Church, the bishops tried to get an audience with him, and he said, "Tell them to go away. I don't want to hear what they're saying." But the Southern Baptists said, "Come on down, George." And the Southern Baptists backed up his attack on Iraq by saying, well, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. And after all, Peter owned a sword.
Yeah. Yeah.
Makes your head hurt.
even if a war were justified, it shouldn't be a spectator sport. And that's what we've made war into. I mean, people sit around their TVs, you know, going hee-haw, hee-haw about somebody getting blown up. You remember the
yep.
first Gulf War?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's what you get out of this crowd. It's all twisting. It's positively medieval, I think. Isn't that fair, Larry? Because while they talk about having people read the Bible, what they don't want them to do is read the Bible and stand and rather sit there and let people nod approvingly who are sort of pretending they did their Sunday school lessons while the preacher tells them what it actually says.
Yeah, well, you know, people like you and I know more about their religion than they do. You know, I run into very few people who have any clue as to what it's all about.
And that's the way it's supposed to work. I just got another update in the email, Larry, on Pat Boone. He's a convert of sorts. You know, because as you noted and as the email noted, he was raised Church of Christ.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have no business singing next to a pianer. But he was a convert to some sort of Pentecostality, you know, with all the rolling on the floor and handling the snakes and drinking the strychnine and speaking in tongues. And he even witnessed a prophecy given to then-Governor Ronald Reagan that he would be president of the United States. It's just astonishing. And here's the fun part. You'll probably understand a little bit of this meaning. When he was in college, he was also a fraternity man. Care to guess which fraternity?
I don't.
Kappa Alpha Order. Does that ring a bell with you?
No. I was never a fraternity person. I was a commuter.
Ah, okay, okay. Well, if a lot of Southerners will recognize that fraternity. Kappa Alpha Order is the fraternity that is steeped in the tradition of the Old South. And until fairly recently, they even prided themselves on throwing parties in which their members showed up in blackface.
Ah.
Yeah. Nice bunch.
Yeah. Yeah.
They wave the Confederate flag, all of that stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. You know, it comes out these days and it's sort of in code. And so you have to be familiar with the phrases and such.
So I don't know. I don't know if Mark Levine knew how close to the mark he was when he said that he was nominating Pat Boone for the Grand Dragon or Wizard Dragon, whatever, the KKK, because he was a member of an organization that is sort of the KKK's, I don't know, literati, college association, whatever, KA. You betcha.
Uh huh. Well, that's a piece of information I didn't know, because I went to school in the North, and I had no contact with fraternities, because, hey, they cost money.
Well, they do. In my case, they prove cheaper than dormitory living.
Oh.
because I started at a little liberal arts college where everybody was a member of one. If it had been a bigger, more pretentious school, I wouldn't have joined an organization that would have had young me as a member.
Uh-huh.
But I did. I became a member of Fiji, and we had a tradition of painting ourselves purple. the stuff in the course of an adulthood, the stuff that you have to get through, the stuff that you have to work through. But it was actually called Fiji because it was the Greek letter phi and the Greek letter gamma, phi, g, therefore Fiji. And the icon okay. Sort of followed from it. But I'm sure I'm driving. No, Bob, no, you wasn't one of them. Yeah, I was. But, you know, a lot of these things, Larry, like college fraternities, they have a very, very respectable origin because they were originated by young men who were, given the times, part of the American Enlightenment. And they went to universities and colleges and they studied the classics and they studied the scholars and they studied foreign languages and had the classic liberal arts education. And all of these fraternities started as debating societies. I don't know that they knew that there would ever be, you know, an animal house. But they started out as noble, liberal arts and liberally oriented debating societies and became doctors and teachers and lawyers and scientists and things like that. Admirable things. One of the founders of my organization is buried somewhere down in Louisiana, and literally one of the first six badges that the fraternity produced, his was auctioned off to pay for his burial. Because he was a teacher and he died in poverty. So it's not, yeah. There's more there than meets the eye. But I tell you what, I've got another email in here, and I think we'll have a lot of fun with it later in the evening. The guide to biblical marriage, because I got started on this, and lo and behold, our buddy Maura sent this along, because I've got one more sanctity of marriage verse here for that you might enjoy, Larry.
Okay.
This is the follow up after the you have to marry your rapist part.
Okay.
So remember, the rape engendered the marriage, And then they pulled a Jacob and his sons pulled a slicky. Well, mainly it was Simeon and Levi pulled a slicky on the Shechemites because Jacob told them the only way that they could have his rape daughter's hand in marriage was if they all got their penises mutilated.
Uh-huh.
And so all the men got circumcised, every last one of them. And, you know, when you've been as a full grown male, when you've just been circumcised, you're not up to a lot of fighting and carrying on. And so while everybody was sort of laid out, all the men were also, you know, recovering, Simeon and Levi, the two sons of Jacob, went in and slaughtered him to the last man. Nice, huh?
Yeah, I remember that story. I think I brought it up to a couple of Jehovah's Witnesses that came by one time.
And here's what they did after slaughtering all the men. After they went around and killed a few, they also attacked the wounded, and then they pillaged the town on the pretext of their sister's dishonor. They took away the flocks, the cattle, the donkeys, and whatever there was in the town and in the countryside. They carried off all their riches, all their little children, and all their wives, and looted everything to be found in their houses. And Jacob was pissed. Why? Well, because his sons had just gone and committed cold-blooded, open-handed murder. No, Jacob wasn't really mad about that. Jacob wasn't exactly known for the breadth and depth of his morals, if you actually read the book, that is. If you talk to some fundamentalist, he's a great man, he was the father of Israel, his name was Israel. I got a feeling he had to have his name changed to Israel so he could, you know, it was an alias, it was an AKA kind of situation. You know, because his name was Mud after this. So he looked at Simeon and Levi and he said, "You've done me harm. You've put me in a bad odor with the people of this land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. I have few men, whereas they will unite against me to defeat me and destroy me and my family. So it's not you, you know, you dirty, stinking, rotten, filthy little murderers. It's, well, wait a minute. You've harmed my reputation. We won't be on the A party list anymore." And Simeon and Levi looked at him and said, "Dad, is our sister to be treated like a whore?" So that was apparently the sanctity of marriage was akin to prostitution in those days.
Yeah.
And then there's the courtship, Larry, of another of Jacob's sons, a fellow by the name of Judah. And Judah left his brothers, this is chapter 38, Judah left his brothers to go down and stay with an Adullamite named Hurah. Now, we don't know who Hurah was. There's nothing that said that Hurah was female. There, Judah saw the daughter of a Canaanite called Shua. And he made her his wife and slept with her. Nothing in there about they entered into the sanctity of God-given marriage. Nothing in there about holy matrimony. He said, it's like the opening lines from Green Acres. I get, "You are my wife. Goodbye, city life." And he slept with her, and they were married.
Well, you know, how many of the people actually have read any of that stuff? Just about nobody.
I know, but it's such fat. You know, on to be fair, Larry, I don't think this. No, I know. Okay, you know how I am about that word "believe." I know this is not the inspired word of God.
Okay, it didn't even happen.
A bunch of it didn't. I know it's not the inspired word of God. There's nothing sacred or holy about it. But being a secular humanist, I can look at this and I can feel real, not God-inspired, but real human compassion for these tales that might have some seed of fact about them regarding the attempt the ongoing attempt in any time, any place, any era of any of us just to get through life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's like all the ancient literature, you know, the Iliad, the Aeneid, you know, all that stuff they made us read. There's something worthwhile in it, I suppose. You know, Aesop's Fables.
Yeah, well, you know, Mark Levine mentioned in his program, Larry, the idea of romantic love and the fact that it hasn't been around just a whole lot. That it's a fairly modern coinage, and there are some places in this world where it's still not welcome. And I got to thinking, if you think back on Greek civilization, ancient Greek civilization, you know, another one of those places where we have real reverence, the stuff that gets written during the classical period really doesn't have any romantic love in that either. You have to go back to pre-classic. You have to go back to the Iliad. And that it's really, really, if you've read it, it's really, really out of place. The scene between Andromache and Hector. And Hector is, of course, painted as this incredibly noble individual, which he appears to have been, who knew he was going to get killed going out to face Achilles, but had no choice but to go. And this scene between him and his wife Andromache and their little son Astyanax before he left. And there's real passion and there is real romantic love in that. And with the exception of the poetry of Sappho, it doesn't happen again in all of ancient civilization. For the most part. I mean, even the stuff that's passed off as love poetry in the Old Testament or the story of Esther or any of that stuff, there's no love involved with that. There's a lot of lust, and there's a lot of pillaging and smiting, but very next to nothing in the way of romantic love. But that's not that hard to understand, is it? Those were hard times and hard people. And romantic love is for people who have a lot more leisure, I guess.
Yeah, well, even in our country's history, there were a lot of hard times for a lot of people. And, you know, you just think back, you know, about your own family, you know, and there are a lot of people that they spent all their time just getting by.
Yeah. Well, what is that old Italian proverb? Bed is the poor man's opera. if you're subsistence living and every day is a struggle, that may be the only enjoyment and the only pleasure you get out of life. You know, 100 years ago wasn't like what we have today with 92,000 forms of leisure competing for your leisure dollar. There were no leisure dollars, and there was very little leisure.
Some of the things that they did do back, in the 19th century, late 19th century, was they had debates. That would be a big thing that happened in town occasionally.
The Chautauqua circuit, we talked about that a little bit on the program, yeah.
And they had lectures. I was reading up on Ingersoll, who was spent most of his time in my hometown of Peoria, Illinois. They actually have a statue of him there. And I was reading about him giving a talk in Fairbury, Illinois, which is, you know, maybe 50 miles from there. He took the train there and gave us a talk in a hall of freethinkers. So many people showed up that you know, the fire marshal said there were too many people in there, and so they cut a new door in the building with a saw so that it would meet fire code. And it just happened that my grandfather had lived in that town, so I went there to see what it looked like. And the building is now a dry cleaner's. Nobody knew about the history of it. But apparently, you know, lectures and stuff drew a big crowd back those days. I guess they didn't have movies.
Well, it required a lot of active mental participation. You know, my favorite agnostic, or perhaps atheist, depending on how we characterize people, is Mark Twain.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody who writes the War Prayer or Letters to the Earth or The Mysterious Stranger or The Man Who Corrupted Hadleyburg could ever be considered within the realm of a man of faith. But, you know, he went on the lecture circuit to correct his disastrously managed finances and gathered in humongous crowds the world over. And, you know, I guess it's convenient that we can sit at home and get things like the neat little documentary I saw on PBS last night. But there's an intellectual interchange that happens in that other situation, in that other venue or scenario that you can't get from your TV. Because the TV just talks at you. It never talks to you. And it certainly doesn't talk with you. And so maybe that's a little reflection of what we've got trying to go on here.
Okay, Bob. Hey, I got to go.
All right. Well, Larry, it's always a pleasure to hear from you. And indeed, do celebrate the season for all the right reasons.
Oh, yeah. And I encourage everybody to read up on it and see what is written in their King James.
Well, here. And if you have any further contact with our pals at American Atheists, tell them I said hello.
Okay, we got a convention coming up.
Oh, when's that? I know you got to go, but...
Well, it's over Easter. It'll be in Atlanta.
Oh, goodness me, how I'd love to figure out a way to come down there and broadcast. That would be a blast. Larry, take care.
Okay.
Bye now. You know, for those of you who haven't, atheists, freethinkers, agnostics are some of the most pleasant people in the world to be around. Because it's kind of like the lights are on for them, and they know what world they're living in. So, I don't know. Maybe it's something worth working on somewhere along the way. Broadcasting live from the International Atheist Easter Meeting. Wouldn't that be fun? That would be. And by the way, a programming note. Just saw this in the chat room. Programming note, Guy James will likely not be on the air tomorrow. He's got jury duty. He notes, this is four times in the last 8 years in a county with 600,000 population. He said either there's more crime than I thought or somebody likes me at the courthouse. So Guy will be fulfilling his civic obligations, so we will have a rerun from 3 to 5. But, you know, tune in if you missed any part of any program in the last few days. You never know. And you know what? Even if you heard it before, there might be something there that will provoke further thought. That's one of the neat things about, it's almost biblical now, isn't it? This is, after all, prayer meeting. It's almost biblical because you can get meaning out of it time and time again. But we haven't done a real Bible-based prayer meeting in a while. So just to show you, because we're here in a little bit, we will do the thing, the audio of radical fundamentalist cleric Mike Huckabee's appearance on The Daily Show, where he talks about biblical marriage. And thanks to our friend Mara, I have some verses here from about biblical marriage, and I'm gonna get back into my old time fundamentalist skills and see how quickly I can riffle through the Bible to find verse after verse after verse, and we'll just see what it is exactly that these fundamentalists are talking about when they talk about marriage between a man and a woman. Here's a great example, however. I mentioned this with Larry. The story of Judah and Tamar. See, by the way, the fundies are all wrought because of a Newsweek cover article about gay marriage in the last week or so that says that there's nothing explicitly forbidding. And there's not. Even if you look at crazy old Paul's talks about homosexuality, he doesn't do it in the context of marriage. He talks about it in terms of adultery and what one does outside of a committed, oh, Lord, what the Fundies would call Christ-centered relationship. He doesn't say, and it was, so, you know, it was so prevalent in the society, maybe there were people who, I don't know. Anyway, the story of Judah and Tamar. This is just a beautiful one. This is biblical marriage in a nutshell. This is biblical marriage 101 from Genesis chapter 38. I'm sure it would be much prettier in the King James Version, but I've got this slightly better translation from the Jerusalem Bible. As I said, it happened at that time that Judah left his brothers, you know, two of them being Simeon and Levi, who were mass murderers, but never mind. Left his brothers to go down, now stop that, and stay with an Adullamite called Hurah. Son, where are you going? Hurah! There, Judah saw the daughter of a Canaanite called Shua. And it's not entirely clear whether the Canaanite was named Shua or his daughter. I'm assuming, but, you know, since the woman was a woman, and this being the Bible and everything, women don't count. I'm guessing daddy's name was Shua. There Judah saw the daughter of a Canaanite called Shua. He made her his wife. He made her his wife. And how did he do that? Pixie dust? Flowers? Chocolate? No, you wouldn't get chocolate until the Spanish came over and committed genocide against the Native Americans some 3,000 years later. No. Falafel? It worked for Bill O'Reilly. He made her his wife and slept with her. Well, at least he made her an honest woman first, right? She conceived and gave birth to a son, whom she named Ur.
God!
All this book, there's just little comic gems like that all the way through. Honey, what are you going to name the baby? Ur. No, really. Ur. It's like Monty Python. Yonder, the castle. Ah! That's why you can't let the women name the babies. She conceived and gave birth to a son whom she named Ur. I think that was a birth noise, actually, but never mind. We're dealing with pre-scientific people. She conceived again and gave birth to a son whom she named, now this is from the greatest hits, you're going to remember this name, Onan. Yet again, she gave birth to a son whom she named Shelah. No end to the problems. She was at Chizib when she gave birth to him. Well, that explains why you'd name him Shelah now, doesn't it? All this time we thought a boy named Sue was a brilliant piece of lyricism. You go through life as a boy named Shelah and see if there ain't a few ass kickings in your life. But then again, I guess you're just bound to be named Shelah when you're born at Chizib. So Judah took a wife for his firstborn Wait, how did he take her? No, stop. We're not going there. It's too early in the evening and try to be a little family-oriented. Judah took a wife for his firstborn and her name was Tamar. So that when they were... This is straight out of Abbott and Costello. You gonna invite him to the party? Who are you gonna invite to the party? Tamar. I didn't ask you when, I asked you who. Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, offended Yahweh greatly. We don't know how. Ate a shellfish, wore a piece of clothing that was Dacron polyester cotton blend. You know, smiting came easy because back then, in this part of the book, God is a juvenile delinquent. He's like that Star Trek character. That just put Kirk and Spock and McCoy and Scotty through hell. And it turned out that, son, come home. Yeah, really, a juvenile delinquent, God. Anyway, pissed off God greatly, we're told. And so God brought about his death. I guess it was something different than your garden variety smiting. Maybe boils or frogs and locusts or something. No, that'll come later in Exodus. Then Judah said to Onan, you know, Onan makes some great generators. They really do. And you'll understand why when we get done. Judah said to Onan, take your brother's wife and do your duty as her brother-in-law to produce a child for your brother. To which Onan said, but, and Judah said, what about your brother? No, but Onan had a scrap of morality about him. And being as how he knew that the child would not be his, and that he'd be on the hook to raise, that he would have actually genetically fathered a child that wouldn't even be referred to as his kid, would be raised as the child of Well, Onan spilt his seed upon the ground. Cue the choir. Every sperm is sacred, every sperm is great, and if a sperm gets wasted, God gets quite irate. So he spilled on the... but he didn't just do it once. See, it's the chronic part of it that makes it difficult. That this is what greatly displeased God. I smell a smiting coming. Onan, knowing the child would not be his, spilt his seed on the ground every time he slept with his brother's wife. Aha! That's where the church gets it. No pulling out! Spilt his seed on the ground every time he slept with his brother's wife. See, that's the thing. Onan didn't have a problem boinking his dead brother's wife. That didn't stir Onan's moralistic misgivings. It was the idea of the child not being said to be his. Cultures, cultures, cultures. So every time he sleeps with his brother's wife, Ur's wife. Whose wife? Ur's. Don't stutter. Spilt his seed to the ground every time he slept with his brother's wife to avoid providing a child for his brother. What he did was offensive to Yahweh. So Yahweh brought about his death also. You know what? The agony of psoriasis, the heartbreak of eczema. We don't know. Yahweh just brought about his death. At least they're not blaming the woman. That's kind of out of character for this thing. Usually the woman just gets blamed and that's the end of it. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, widow of Ur, return home as a widow to your father and wait for my son Shelah to grow up. Oh, honey, I think you've got a long wait for Shelah. For Judah was thinking, he must not die like his brothers. So Tamar went back home to her father. Well, there's an interesting concept of divorce. Divorce by widowhood. Old Judah wouldn't even have a part of... He didn't want to have to support her. That's nice. Wow, those are some family values. You can leave now. You haven't produced any heirs for my side of the family. You just go and hang around for 15 or 20 years, and we'll see if Shelah can't come and, you know, get it on with you later. So Tamar went back home to her daddy. And presumably her mother, or this being the Old Testament, mothers. Several of them. Because I'm sure that Tamar's daddy, who was the Canaanite called Shua. No, that wasn't the Canaanite. No, we don't know who Tamar's... we don't know who Tamar's daddy was. But she went home to him to wait it out until Shelah could figure out whether he wanted to marry a woman that had already gone through his two brothers. You know, there's a couple of these stories in the Bible about women who have real unfortunate... There was a demon-possessed one somewhere in here who'd gone through, like, seven guys. It got wedding night, you know. Here I am! And a demon came out and gobbled them up. Yeah. Great. Read this book. I mean, this is a page-turner. I'm all for, you know, the money's tight and everything. I'm all fresh out of books to read. So I've been reading this lately, and it's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating from a humane human perspective. And I'm trying to be careful about passing judgments on tribal customs, because these were, after all, people who had not gotten around to the wheelbarrow yet. I mean, they were, you know, they were clockwise. They were two minutes past Neanderthal. I know, I'll get the letter about the Neanderthals, that they weren't really yada, yada, yada. I know. Okay, let's put it this way. There still came periods of time when they weren't sure why fire happened. Yeah, and had to make up myths about why it rained. So, you know, I try to be a little bit gentle and forgiving. And maybe there was some cultural reason to insist that son after son after son get on some poor widow woman and have at her, whether she wanted it or not. Anyway, we'll continue. We'll continue with this in a minute, but I hate to keep people on hold. Hey, welcome to the program.
Am I on?
You're on. Hey, Dave.
Are you good? How are you?
I'm well. Yourself?
Pretty good. Just listening to your, the biblical stuff. Years back, many years ago, I read both Testaments.
Scarred for life.
Quite an educational thing to do. The Old Testament is completely insane. It really is. You know, you're just reading through that stuff, and if you have any kind of grounding in the world, your mind's just boggled completely by some of the stuff that's in the Old Testament. You know,
absolutely.
It's beyond belief. If someone wrote fiction as bizarre as that, it'd be criticized.
Well, the funny thing is, though, being as I am at least moderately steeped in some other ancient texts, at least in translation, I don't do ancient Hebrew, and I can sort of phonetically three-year-oldishly stumble through some written ancient Greek. And some Latin. So I read it in translation, but there's a common thread in all of these, whether it's the Greeks writing about the misadventures of their gods and goddesses, whom they took completely seriously,
mm-hmm.
Or the ancient Semitic Nilo-Saharan people. That's their language group, by the way. Both Hebrew and Arabic and Aramaic and all those things are called Nilo-Saharan languages, which tells you where the people originally came from. So nobody originally owns that land, just to put that little thing to rest.
Well, who
does?
We own the land.
Right. Who does? But anyway, there's a commonality and with a lot of these ancient so-called holy texts, Dave, that point toward these things being cautionary tales. You know, the fundamentalists and the phony Christians want to act like Abraham's a saint. Well, he wasn't. These are cautionary tales to the people promulgating them, not on how to behave, but how not to behave. Because
look out for these guys.
Yeah. Well, and look out for this situation. It may happen to you. Or look out for this scenario. We all know, and
a lot of wisdom in there.
Yeah,
it's just that you've got to be really careful about picking it out.
But you don't have to be so careful if you're part of the culture that's promulgating it. You see what I'm saying?
If it suits your purpose, for sure.
Well, not even so much that, but if you're part of the culture that archetypically understands that these are not how to behave, but how not to, then, you're not going to have nearly as much trouble with it as, say, a radical fundamentalist cleric like Mike Huckstermann, who thinks it's the inspired word of God.
Yeah, but
you're a man scientifically trained, Dave. You've told us that. And as such, you know that we learn more from our mistakes than we do from our successes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when they were firing up the LHC, unfortunately, they had a small helium leak. But there were two possibilities there. They're going to find the Higgs boson, which is pretty cool in itself. But if they don't, then, woohoo, we've got to start looking for new physics here. You know, so the lack of a result can be more amazing than a result.
Well, exactly. And so, these cultures, whether it's the ancient Greeks or in the Iliad, okay? In the Iliad, all the things that are right with the world and the people who are morally right, the people who are ethically right, the people who have the law on their side, and everything would be in favor of them in the balance, that's the Trojans. They've got the single most moral individuals in the book in the form of Hector and Priam. Paris is a little twit, but, what are you going to do?
I'm pretty light on this stuff. I'm more of a science guy.
But the sleaze bags and gut buckets are, let's see, Agamemnon, who is an egomaniac, who runs around stealing captives from his own generals, Achilles, who is a pouting pretty boy prima donna, truly a diva of the 13th century BCE, and Odysseus. And Odysseus, who is so wily and so crafty, he's such a pathological liar that he can't tell the same lie twice.
Sound like a great bunch.
And so it's an internalized debate within a culture in which the culture warns itself against its own bad habits.
But who listens?
And it's hard to say who listens, because what happens as soon as it becomes promulgated as a sort of the state religion, then form overtakes function. And it's more important to have the book than to know what's in it. And that's true of the ancient Greeks. It's true of the ancient Hebrews. It's true of the Egyptians. And it's true of us.
Oh, for sure.
In the modern era in the United States, I realize you're in Canada, but in the United States, you can see it in the debate over flag burning and the Pledge of Allegiance. You have people who get absolutely apoplectic over the Pledge of Allegiance, which is a Pledge of Allegiance to a flag, and the flag itself is a symbol that stands in place for the Constitution of the United States, which is nothing if not its contents, and the contents of which probably 95% of the people in this country know next to nothing. So form takes over function, and we formalize our worship of the flag and the little prayer that we say to it.
You know what was really bizarre? When I came to Canada, okay, I'm born in England. I'm a Brit. I came to Canada. I married a Canadian. I came over here. And when I went to get my citizenship of Canada, I had to swear allegiance to the Queen. I never had to do that as a Brit.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, Canadians, you can't trust them.
No, but you...
12-pack of Molson and you got revolution on your hands.
No, but that's just so bizarre. That as a Brit who'd lived over there all my life and never had to swear allegiance to the Queen, came to Canada and to get citizenship had to. It was hard to push that out.
Did it feel a little creepy?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, more than a little, I mean, I understand that Canada is a corporation, it really is, I mean, as are all countries when you really come down to it, And so, yeah, that was really bizarre for me. It was really hard to do. It really was. And
I can see where it would be.
Yeah. Because for me, I don't think any person should be required to swear allegiance to anything that they don't feel allegiance for or to.
How about just a blanket promise to mind one's own business and leave alone those that aren't messing with one?
I promise not to hurt anybody unless they try and hurt me first. That'll do for me.
You know what? What's Jesus say in the New Testament? And therein lie the law and the commandments.
Hmm.
Actually, if you go backwards, I mentioned him a little bit ago. I think Hillel said that, because there was some guy who came to Hillel and said, teach me the entire Torah, but only if I'm standing on one foot. And Hillel said, don't hurt anybody who isn't, treat others like you'd like to be treated. There is the Torah, the rest is commentary.
You know, I've always brought my kids up exactly with that. Don't ever do anything to somebody else that you wouldn't like them to do to you. It's a simple rule for life. And that covers almost everything you're ever going to run into. You know? It covers it all. It really does. And this is where, you know, the human rights issue is solved right there. No one's ever going to starve if people look at the world in that way. You know, it's the ramifications of that simple statement are just so mind-bogglingly enormous. I'm now stuck for anything else to say.
I know. That happens to you. Because some of these concepts are fairly simple.
They're so simple. But they're so far-reaching in their simplicity. That's the thing. You know, you can never torture anybody, can you?
Really, I don't think there's never any good reason for it.
No, but I mean, if you live by that rule that you can't do to somebody else anything that you wouldn't quite happily have done to you, well, then torture's just gone out the window. You know, predatory lending's just gone out the window.
Usury at all, Dave. I mean, if you're really, really following the teachings inside this really thick, largely insane book.
But when's the only time in the Bible, I'm an atheist, but anyway, let's look at the Bible. The only time Jesus ever used violence was when he was overturning the tables of the money changers. That is really telling.
Yeah. Now, that's the only time that we know that he got violent. To the extent that we know that he did, and this isn't all made up.
Well, got physical about it.
Yeah,
exactly.
But
I mean,
mercy, he lived a life, whatever is documented in the so-called Gospels, he lived a life of immense frustration.
Yeah. I think he would have been. An anarchist
To a certain extent, he was. To the other end of the extreme. He was also a very, very, I mean, you know, he was within the Jewish tradition, and he followed the law and the prophets, and he knew. And one of the neat things that was mentioned the other last night in what I saw is that if we consider the totality of his circumstances, he was probably trilingual. You ever think about that and what it means? He was a tradesman. He was a carpenter. He grew up in Nazareth, which was a suburb of a big Romanized, Hellenized population center, a city called Sepphoris, that had both Jews, Romans, and Hellenized people in it. So you would need all three languages in order to be able to get along. Not necessarily Latin, but rather Greek, Hebrew, and Aramaic. And that opens up all kinds of doors for where he would have gotten the information that he had.
What I always find really bizarre about that part of the world is the fact that Jerusalem is the holy city of three different religions.
Yeah, but when you get right when you get right down to it, though, it's really only the holy city of one religion, and two others co-opted it.
Yeah.
Christianity co-opted it because that's where the crucifixion took place, and Islam co-opted it because the their holy book says that Muhammad traveled to the farthest place, if I understand the translation correctly. It doesn't even mention Jerusalem by name, but by virtue of tradition, it has become the third holiest place in Islam behind Mecca and Medina, I do believe.
Yeah. I just find all this stuff so bizarre.
Well, it is. We have a lot of fun on prayer meeting night just because we can poke a little fun at something that a bunch of people who know next to nothing about it put so much into and treat so seriously. You know, I gotta give props to the Jewish faith at least, because they really do pay attention to their scripture and try to understand it. And I love that honor that analytical tradition.
To a point, but I mean, laws that made sense in a desert community 4,000 years ago start to look fairly irrelevant in a modern city.
Some of them, yes.
Kosher thing, you know.
Well,
fridge. Well, what the hell?
But you know, it's transformed into a means of communicating with the cloud creature. And all of this is predicated on belief in a cloud creature.
Well,
as noted, the first five books of the Bible, just about the entirety of the Old Testament, God is a juvenile delinquent. I mean, you would not let God have the keys to your car. He'd deliberately run over people in the street, just like that guy in Texas who rear-ended the woman at 100 miles an hour because she wasn't driving in a Christian fashion, and he said God told him to do it. Well, if it's the Old Testament God, he may have.
I was driving in a Christian fashion. How do you do that?
Beats the dickens out of me.
Beats the crap out of me, too. I mean, that's, you know, get the tinfoil hat on quick, you know.
But tradition, you know, tradition is strong. Tradition is very strong.
Tradition in some ways is a kind of a neat thing. I mean, I like what different cultures bring to the table, you know. I love all the foods of all the different cultures. I'm a big food fan. And I really think diversity enriches everybody. It doesn't hurt anybody if you approach it in the right way. You know what I mean? Come on. I can't claim to be right. So I can't impose my will on you.
Right. And look, you know, tradition exists culturally. Tradition exists macro and micro. Okay.
Yeah, you've got family traditions, and you've got, you know.
If we have the wherewithal to do it, we have a tradition that we have kept up through thick and thin, and every year for as long as Agnes and I have had our little family together, that, you know, we do a standing rib of beef. Oh, please, vegetarians, just don't call. I know. But we do a standing rib of beef on Christmas. Okay. And I do a traditional Yorkshire pudding in an iron skillet that has been handed down through five generations of my family.
Yeah.
And there's nothing special about the iron in that skillet except for what we put into it.
Mm-hmm.
And that iron skillet is a mnemonic for remembering the blood, the sweat, the tears, and the labor that went into living those five generations among all those people. This is the fourth generation to live in this house. You can't live around that without reverencing that to one degree or another. It's why at the Passover that somebody has to ask that ritual question: why do we eat bitter herbs? To remind us of the bitterness of our bondage in Egypt. And it serves a greater function. And to that end, there's value in it. But
the problem is that it's then used as an excuse, like you're remembering that the bitterness towards what the Egyptians did how many years ago? You know, and okay, remember it, but then say, okay, so now we got to figure out why the hell that happened, and let's not do it again.
Or if it did. You know, there is not well, yeah, there's not one iota of evidence.
No. But
of what's recorded in Exodus of this, and then came a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. There's no evidence of it at all. And
I don't think there's any evidence for anything religious. And therein lies the problem.
Religious, no. Existence, yes. I mean, all the tells in the Middle East, all the cities, you know, Jericho existed. All right, the fortress above the plain at Megiddo, Har Megiddo, Armageddon. You know, it's all how you treat it in the language that existed. But it's the mythology that got built up. You know, Mount Olympus is real. But there aren't any dancing gods on top of it. By the time, I guess, that the Greeks got around to building their whole city at Olympus, the gods had to bug out and go hide.
Well, I mean, if you got all the riffraff living around you and you were the gods, wouldn't you live away?
Yeah, here come the hoi polloi.
You know, I know. I find religion fascinating and scary, and
well, religion in many ways, Dave. Religion is like watching a malevolent virus reproduce itself under a microscope. How can you not watch that and be fascinated by it? But if you pull back and you realize the reality of what that virus does, it's, you know, I think we got to figure out a way to get rid of this thing before it hurts anybody. And ultimately, that should be the progress of humanity. We got to figure out a way to get rid of religion before it hurts any more than it already has.
Well, I mean, religion has caused probably more and bloodier wars throughout the centuries than just about anything else you can think of.
Heavens to Betsy.
By the bankers to use it.
I mean, I went through this business out of Genesis chapter 38 here, and you got two guys getting dropped. One, for no apparent reason, he just pissed off God, and God dropped him. You know, he's like something out of a Warner Brothers cartoon, just walks around dropping grand pianos and anvils on people's heads. You know, I think it was supposed to work out this way. Chuck Jones said that Bugs Bunny was who we all wanted to be, and Daffy Duck was who we really were. and after a while, you begin to feel some sympathy for the coyote. You don't run out on the promontory. It's going to break off. And even and if you're standing on the other side, the promontory will stand in midair, and the rest of you will fall into the canyon. And you begin to sympathize, not with that annoying little roadrunner, but with the poor coyote who's just trying to get a bite to eat, for the love of God.
And I always think the politicians are Elmer Fudd.
Yeah. You know, Daffy Duck, you know. And why would they be calling you the Dragon Lady? You know, and he's sitting there, and all his pin feathers are charred and turned black. You know, we ask questions that we're better off not asking. We pursue things that we know are bad for us, and we do them anyway. And that, you know, that's the story of humanity. I mean, I'm sure that when that first proto-human came down out of the trees, there was somebody up in the tree going, "What do you want to go there? This is an orange tree. There's food and there's leaves and nuts and berries, and we can go tree to tree. And then, what do you want to go down on the savanna for?"
Well, that's like Douglas Adams said, you know, coming down from the trees was human's first big mistake.
Yes. You know, you got the natives who come across from Asia into North America, and when they first get here, it's like, "Hey, Barney, look at wall-to-wall primate rib." "Oh, yeah, Fred, we're going to eat good. Get Wilma and Betty. This is going to be great." 10,000 years later, no more woolly mammoths. No more giant ground sloths.
I read something recently, and I can't give you the name, but the concept was if every insect on the planet was to disappear today, in 50 years, there'd be no life on Earth. If today every human was to disappear, in 50 years, life would flourish.
Yeah, true.
And this is what people have to get hold of and realize that they're part of it, not separate from it. We've been taught for so long that we, and this goes back to Christianity, where man was given dominion over nature. You know, that is the beginning of the problem that we're now running into.
It is. You know, Tom, at the end of one of my favorite books, Still Life with Woodpecker, Tom Robbins says he hasn't learned much, but he's learned a few things. One of the things he's learned is that everything is part of it. And it's just, you know, put out there, there's no specifics. Everything is part of it.
You know, I was sitting outside. I live in an apartment building down by Lake Ontario. And I was sitting out one night just watching the swallows catching bugs on the wing, you know, and thinking, how amazing is nature that you've got these birds that fly around and they've developed a way of catching these little bugs, and they can catch enough bugs to sustain the kind of energy they have to put out to catch those bugs. And how, you know, bats, you know, eat thousands of mosquitoes, and how important they are in the overall scheme of things, and how bees, a third of all the food that we eat, every one in three mouthfuls of food that goes down your throat relies on insects. Why the hell would you want to blow insecticides all over the place?
Well, because that's really good for the quarterly profit and loss margin for Bayer Crop Sciences, who manufacture Larvin, brought to you by Bayer.
Okay, so there's 6 billion people on the planet, and how many people benefit directly from what Bayer do? The shareholders, how many of those are there compared to 6 billion people who pay the price for the profits they make?
Yeah, my son's learning about ratios in math right now, and I think I'll use that example with him. That's a good one, Dave.
You know, this is what people have to start thinking about, the numbers. Just look at the benefits. Look at the ratio of cost and benefit for everything that you do and everything that people are doing. Ooh, Monsanto. Somebody.
Yeah, I just saw Lottie post Monsanto there.
Oh, Monsanto, the devil incarnate. I mean, come on. Monsanto.
Yeah, Roundup Ready corn.
Suicide seed. You know, hormones for milk that's unnecessary, causes cows to suffer and causes humans to drink stuff. Oh, God, no, don't look. Monsanto, ag.
Yeah, Frankenspuds. No. Remember Frankenspuds?
My toenails are curling just at the mention of Monsanto.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, Frankenspuds, and that's the one that blew me away. That was the potato that Monsanto genetically engineered to include an enzyme from a goat.
Yeah. What the hell is
that? That would kill the potato bug when the potato bug took a bite of the potato plant. I don't want to eat goat enzyme. I mean, I've said on a number of occasions, Dave, that I am being driven toward vegetarianism. And, you know, I can, I got nothing.
I absolutely understand that. You know, I've said that to my kids. I've said that. And I've said that even the vegetables aren't safe, just that they're safer.
Well, yeah. And, but you know, if companies, if corporations like Monsanto get their way, your own garden patch isn't safe, because if one of their seeds blows into your garden and happens to sprout,
well,
they'll sue you.
There's a Canadian farmer. You know exactly what you're talking about there. I can't remember his name, but
Yeah, but most people
basically lost his farm because he said the seeds blew over. Monsanto threw $28,000, you know, $280,000, $2 million, whatever dollars worth of lawyers at him. And he couldn't fight and lost his farm. And Monsanto gained the farm. So they can now grow their GM shit on it. Sorry.
And it's not, that's for the cooks in the audience, most of whom probably already know this. We know that, say, cooking with corn with canola oil is safer than cooking with, you know, lard. Okay? But
he's on an island right now.
But wait, I dare and defy anyone to go find me a picture of a canola plant.
Mm-hmm.
There's no such thing.
Well, I'm a big fan of olive oil personally.
Canola, though, within the context of this conversation, Dave, is fascinating because canola is actually what's called rapeseed oil, R-A-P-E-seed, rapeseed oil, but a a Canadian corporation has dibs on rapeseed oil production, patents, yada, yada, yada. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say that they're part of the Council on Foreign Relations or the Trilateral Commission or they've been to Bohemian Grove or any of that stuff. But they've got a lock on rapeseed oil production so that, and marketing, because, you know, nobody wants, could you bring me a jug of rapeseed oil on the way home, Pa?
Yeah.
What is it? Are you going out with Tamar again?
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I don't know. I just find that if you throw logic at the whole thing.
You throw logic at the whole thing, and the whole thing just withers.
Well, no, the problem is that the whole thing just carries on. And you throw all that logic at it, and all that happens is your brain melts down.
No, I think my brain's in pretty good shape. Probably too good a shape, considering what I've done to it, for me to be able to account for it. But
I don't know what you've done at yours, but one of the things that I've done at mine is I've always tried to jam as much stuff into it as I can.
Yeah, with the exception of Sudoku, I can't do it. I won't do it. That just makes me nuts.
What do you get? What have you done at the end of it? I always like to have, if I'm going to do something, I always like to see a result at the end of it. And for me,
well, for me, Sudoku is a very Douglas Adams kind of thing because, 42.
Yeah. No point to it. And I've got too much to do something that has no.
I much prefer being humiliated by the New York Times Sunday crossword.
I don't even go there. For me, puzzles to be solved, I'm really big in, my passion right now is 3D modeling.
Oh, man, that's neat.
And for me, that is kind of, you know, that's what I do when I'm not doing anything else. And for me, that's the problem to be solved. I like to solve problems, but for me, I like to set the problem to be solved for myself, and that's what the 3D.
And have it some end result that has some level of gratification to it.
Yeah, and at the end of it, you can just look at this thing and say, oh, that could be a photograph.
Yeah, and that's problem solving on a grander scale than, you know, coming back around to it. The Daffy Duck school of thought where he's Daffy Duck Private Eye, and I had just finished one case, and he throws the case of beer bottles out the window. I needed a new case. All humor aside, that's the kind of problem solving that the American people are in much of the world, much of the so-called Western world are engaged in.
One of the things that I find, and I'm not trying to sound kind of weird here, but I've not had a television since 1999. And I find that incredibly kind of liberating. I'm not sucked into watching what the corporate monster wants me to see. And what I do with the time that most people do use, you know, to watch television, I do stuff.
Yeah. Exactly. And well, you know, look at
I paint, I read, I do 3D modeling, I try and teach my kids stuff. I try and spend time in a way that rewards rather than a way that just switches my brain off.
Well, you know, I agree wholeheartedly, Dave. Look, for instance, at our end of the day ritual, Agnes and me, lately she, the end of the day is really a blessed event because the babies have stopped crying, the homework's done, everybody's asleep, and she and I, retreat, to our little haven, and being middle-aged married people, jump under the sheets, And she gets her vampire book out, and I'm reading the Bible. Whew. Yeah, but at least it's making the wheels of the mind turn. And, you know, frankly, in that circumstance, every now and then I'll go, hey, honey, put down the vampire a minute. You got to hear this.
Oh, yeah, and she probably does, you know, do the same to you.
And we say...
I mean, I'm now separated, I'm, you know, single. So I don't have that as a luxury, but, you know, I know what you mean.
We talked about traditions, and that's a tradition that I come from. As a kid growing up, sitting in the living room with my mother and father, each of them with their own newspaper, and me sitting there on the couch, and one of them, hey, wait a minute, you got to hear this, and then the cackling would ensue,
mm-hmm.
and we'd all wind up gasping for breath, and while you know they didn't leave me a trust fund or anything, if my parents left me anything. The greatest gift they left me was the ability to find humor and see humor and to laugh uproariously.
Mm-hmm.
Because we'd have those laughing fits. You know the ones that come and you can't stop?
Well, my grandfather, he was absolutely insane. He was a little guy. He was 5'2". He was terribly burned in World War One. Never talked about it. Showed the scars for all his life, had a wicked sense of humor. He was as fit as you could ever imagine a guy of 70 to be. He used to play in the streets with the kids when I was small and play, you know, kicking a ball about. And he wasn't waiting for the ball to come along. He was as fit as you could imagine. And his sense of humor was just insane. And one of the things he always used to say to me when I was little, and it sticks with me, it'll always stick with me, was, you know, something. All the world is mad except for thee and me. And he used thee and, you know, thee and thou and all that.
Right.
Stuff. All the world's mad except for thee and me, and I'm not sure about thee. And that will always stick with me.
As well it should. Dave, thanks for the conversation. I do appreciate it. Never hesitate to chime in. I love this stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is what it's all about. This is the cool stuff. And that's why I keep phoning you. Anyway, you have a good night.
All right. Take care.
And talk to someone else.
Hey, one of these days you got to shoot a picture there of the shores of Lake Ontario and send it along. I'd love to see that. All right. Bye now.
Don't care. Bye.
And, you know, that applies to all of you. What does your world look like? What does it look like from where you stand? Send them along. You know, we'll create a little album page on the website. I don't know. Call it The View Out My Window. And that brings us all just a little bit closer together, I think. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's me, Jared.
Hey, what's up?
Oh, not much. Just wanted to say something real quick.
Okay.
You were talking about, because I got to get off at 8.
Oh, sorry.
But Overman's coming on. Anyway, you were talking about Jesus and where he was living at that time and how he might have been trilingual.
Mm-hmm.
That is likely, but it's highly unlikely. Most people, they would have their own home language, you know, which you spoke with your parents.
Right.
Then they had their commercial language.
Right.
And that was usually Greek.
Right.
When the Romans would conquer in that area, they didn't have the time or the patience to teach people to speak Latin.
Right. And
they just spoke Greek with them.
Yeah, I kind of caught my own mistake. What I was thinking more in terms of was Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure he had a smattering of it here and there, but it's highly unlikely.
Well, as a carpenter, a technician, he kind of had to be able to say, you know, how tall, how wide.
Yeah. But that's commerce, then he probably learned Greek. That was in Greek,
right?
If anything. All right. Well, thanks.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye.
Bye. You guys are great. And of course, none of that implied. Well, I don't know. I meant to ask Mark Levine about this, or maybe Betsy. I know that the Jewish religion has a profound emphasis on literacy. And I don't know if that's a function of the diaspora or if that has been the way, you know, for as long as there's been as long as there's been written Hebrew. But as a rabbi, you have to assume that Yeshua would have had a degree of literacy, I assume. That in terms of the written language. Aramaic, not so much. Greek, highly unlikely. Although I love the idea of Jesus sitting around what would you have back then? A wine break? A water break? Well, to him it's the same either way. Reading a little Plato, because so many of his ideas are in fact Platonic, but so many of his ideas are Buddhist as well. Either one of those just drives the fundamentalists nuts. As if, you know, because any comedian will tell you that nobody ever has an original idea. Everything is built upon. Oh, and by the way, from earlier in the program, the outfit that Susan was talking about doing such a decent turn by her. We are family. This is a community. And if you want to thank the folks, you're more than welcome to do so. They have a web presence. Our buddy David in Tennessee looked it up and found it. EastsideHeating.com, just like it sounds, EastsideHeating.com. And so they've even got a contact button there. 7200 Johnson Creek Boulevard, Portland, Oregon, 97206. They can be reached at info@EastsideHeating.com. And they did a very, very good thing by a member of our family. And if you want to send them a note of thanks for that good turn, I think that would be entirely appropriate. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, good evening, Bob.
Hey, Ed, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Sound like y'all are doing okay.
Oh, you know, every now and then it's fun to have a little Bible study.
Yeah, well, you do. Doing real good, but you know, I've read a little bit of it, but I'm not as deep into it as the ones that call in and yourself. But the reason I called up was not against the grain to...
No, anything is fair game, Ed.
Okay, well, I just wanted to tell you if you had picked up on the National Republican chairman... trying to tie Obama to this thing.
Oh, you know, it almost goes without saying that they would do it. I know exactly what you're talking about, Ed. I got an email here today from one of these right-wing websites that I follow. Barack Obama, what did he know and when did he know it?
And, you know, the other part of it is, old Bill Bennett, as bad as I dislike him, he's on this Beckley station now too, real early in the morning.
Oh, is he really? That's just disgusting.
Yeah, well,
that's the guy who wanted to abort all the black babies.
Yeah, another one of the Rush Limbaughs or Limp Hogs or whatever you call them. But he come up with his program was, or he came up with the program that they were discussing. Obama and the potential. One guy called in, well, he would just bet anything that Obama knew this, that he was in with the gang and part of the machine and all this. And I have to give Bennett credit. He said, well, now we got to assume innocence until proven guilty. And I think he really tanked that guy out that called in because he wanted old Bill. He thought of Bill Bennett would sanction it, that it could be baptized and hung on the wall, you know.
Yeah, I know.
This CNN, you got a couple blabbermouth women, and it ain't a lick at all women, but get on there and speculate. You know, news is anymore on all these stations, if you call that news, it's speculation and a matter of opinion. Don't have to be a matter of fact at all. And it's just disgusting. they are determined to drag Obama down. You know, it ain't like he ain't got enough on his shoulders already. Some of these commentators and especially like the ones that call in on the morning show here in this area,
right,
for the people that's listening don't know, we got another miniature, and I do mean miniature, Rush Limbaugh in this area, and his callers is all great speculators and know it. It's funny how all of them know something, but they couldn't win dog catcher if they run for it.
Yeah.
It just fascinates me that they know so much and ain't there. Don't even know how to mow their own backyard, most of them.
But, or find their way out of the basement, sure.
Yeah. But I just thought I'd call and aggravate you by calling in, instigating and interrupting your church session.
Oh, it's not church. It's Bible study. It's
Yeah.
That's the thing. You know, when you study it, you actually learn what's in it.
Yeah.
And when you learn what's in it, you go,
oh! Well, there's a lot. There's a lot in there that if you got to read between the lines, that actually what happened. You know, we're taught today against adultery and stuff like that. That went on pretty regular in the Old Testament.
Kind of hard. Well, you know, in Genesis and Exodus, it's kind of hard to tell what is and isn't adultery because no one was behaving like an adult.
You go all the way back to Boaz. Who was it, Boaz and Ruth or Naomi or whoever, whichever one it was? It spoke about her sleeping between his legs or getting up early before daylight and leaving after staying with him all night. But people do not see what must have happened, you know, and that's speculation too, you know. It might not have. But the odds are greatly against something like that
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, but then again, I try to read this like a fundamentalist reads it, Ed, and take it literally word for word fact. And if you take most of the book of Genesis as word for word fact, you're just horrified.
Mm-hmm.
Because the conduct that is recounted in there is disgusting. You got the patriarch, Abraham, revered by three religions, a name that is practically worshipped by billions of people on this planet. And what did he do, Ed? Well, he went down into Egypt, and he pimped out his wife. He really did. That's the only word for it.
How do you get that out of that? I'm trying to learn. I'm not questioning your.
No. Well, there's nothing to. I mean, it's in the text. I'm taking it literally. He went down into Egypt. Well, he did it. Well, he did it in Egypt, and he did it somewhere else too. He did it in the land of the Negev. In the land of the Negev. But he also did it down in Egypt. Got it right here. Okay. Well, let's take the Negev part of it. Chapter 20 of Genesis. Abraham left there for the land of the Negev and settled between Kadesh and Shur, staying for the time being at Gerar. Of his wife Sarah, Abraham said, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, the great king of Gerar, had Sarah brought to him. But God visited Abimelech in a dream at night. "You are to die," he told him, "because of the woman you have taken, for she is a married woman." And Abimelech, however, had not gone near her, so he said, "My lord, would you kill innocent people too? Did he not tell me himself, 'She is my sister'? And did she not herself say, 'He is my brother'? I did this with a clear conscience and clean hands."
Yeah, I remember reading that.
Abraham pimped his wife out.
Yeah.
And he did it more than once.
But see, that's not the interpretation of the way it's taught to you and the way it's said in...
The
fundamentalist, you know.
Right, because you can't be doing any truth.
They try to make it appear like that he would die, or that they one or the other of them would get killed, is the teaching of it.
But what happens after that, Ed? Abimelech rose early the next morning and, summoning all his servants, told them the whole story, at which the men were very much afraid. Then summoning Abraham, Abimelech said to him, "What have you done to us? What wrong have I done you that you bring so great a sin on me and on my kingdom? You've treated me as you should not have done." And he goes on, and Abraham says, "Well, because I thought there'd be no fear of God here, and the people would kill me because of my wife." Because it goes on and on about how beautiful Sarah was.
Yeah. Well, that's...
And then Abraham shakes down Abimelech for a bunch of goods. And he shakes down Pharaoh in Egypt, too. It was a racket.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the part they stress, only they put that first. The reason that they introduced her as his sister was because he was afraid of getting killed. And that's the approach that the fundamentalists use.
Well, it's one thing to say it's your sister, but it's another thing to try to marry her off.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they were going to do is marry her off and get the dowry, because apparently, if you read further, they really were brother and sister. So you got incest added into the mix, too.
God. Well, see, so you don't, even the study Bible don't reveal any of that.
No, you have to actually read it.
Yeah, you have to see past what the teaching and what the general concept has been put before you all your life. Yeah, I agree.
And it goes, and then you go a little further in Genesis, and apparently it's a family tradition, because other people use this same shakedown.
Well, they must have had the overall scope of the people back then, must have been accepted as a way of life then, right? Or was it? Or was that just his? Probably sounds like God condemned it, but they went against all that and went their own way with it.
Yeah, I think it was. It's a racket that they ran. You've got. It's interesting because right before Genesis chapter 20 starts, Ed, you've got Genesis chapter 19, and the last thing that's discussed. In Genesis chapter 19, before chapter 20 starts, is the story about how Lot settles in the hill country with his two daughters. They don't give their names. You know, they're women. They don't count in the Bible. But they're living in a cave, and the elder daughter said to the younger daughter, "Our father is an old man, and there's not a man in the land to marry us in the way they do the world over." There's your traditional family-oriented marriage.
Mm-hmm.
"Come, let us ply our father with wine and sleep with him. In this way we shall have children by our daddy."
Yeah.
That night they made their father drunk, and the elder slept with her father, though he was unaware of her coming to bed or of her leaving. And the next day the elder said to the younger, "Last night I slept with my father. Let's make him drunk again tonight, and you go and sleep with him. In this way we shall have children by our father."
Yeah, I remember reading one.
Now, call me crazy, but that's sick.
Yeah. Well.
And see, but because the Bible is male-centric and women take all the grief, notice how that's all laid off on the girls?
Mm-hmm.
You ever known a man to get drunk that didn't lift the glass to his own lips?
No. The indication is, though, that they did it, that they got him that way. I mean, the blame was there.
Well, I mean, this is before anybody ever invented intravenous fluids or anything, so they couldn't run it into his arm, and they didn't have a needle to inject it into him. He drank it willingly.
Yeah. Well, the book also tells us that we all have crimes of like passion, and it shows up today in our cultures, the same thing, only they don't have to be drunk to do it anymore.
And then, you know, it does go on and tell us that, indeed, because they committed incest with their father, that they both got pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there wasn't one of those no harm, no foul kind of situations. That's the fun thing. Most of these communities that want to pass anti-pornography legislation, Ed, if they actually managed to do it, the first thing you'd have to ban would be the Bible, because it's the dirtiest book in the world.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, and I'm not my subjective. This is, it's just the words that are in the book.
Yeah, but don't you think that it's also an example of what we shouldn't do?
Sure it is. That's what I was saying with Dave a little bit ago, that these are cautionary tales when they're understood within their own culture. It doesn't apply to us. But within the culture in which the book arose, those are cautionary tales to tell people what not to do because of the because we learn from our mistakes and not from our successes. But there's nothing. But by the same token, Ed, there's nothing in all of that I just read to you about those girls jumping their daddy.
Yeah.
There's nothing in there that says, and God was displeased with them for doing it. Nothing.
Well, what really keeps it, what are the, you think the three factors are that keeps that from happening, or keeps trying to keep the standard up, the three factors that try to keep the standard up on from doing that today?
Now, how do you mean?
Well, what keeps us from just arbitrarily doing that today, in today's times?
Because we also live in a culture with unwritten rules, and some of them are even written, too. I mean, incest is a crime.
That's one of them. Exactly. It's a crime, and it's a standard, and it's a standard that I think is covered in the New Testament, that we shouldn't do those things. Plus, today, I'm not sure what the penalty was physically back in that time, but today, that type of relationship between father and daughter and daughter and mother and or son and mother and so forth, it creates a breed of people with physical defects.
To some extent, yeah. We have consanguinity laws that speak to, you know, cousins can't marry cousins and yada yada yada. Earlier laws went into much deeper degree of consanguinity and transanguinity or whatever. Where there was no effect, we know now there was no effective genetic relationship. And oddly enough, however, for the most part, all that cousins can't marry cousins business was always applied to everybody but the royalty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that goes back to the pharaohs.
Yeah. Well, I had a cousin, a distant cousin, that wanted me to ask my sister to go out with him. And I just plainly, I said, all right, what kind of crazy bastard are you? I said, that's blood on blood. And I said, you're not even welcome to our house no more. And I haven't seen the guy now for 45 years.
Probably just as well.
I guarantee he won't ever come around none of them. That whole family is sort of odd. And because I'm against any kind of that cousin. You know, we've got a reputation. It's, I don't know who, whether it was Cheney or somebody said they only do that in West Virginia. You know what? People got madder and heck at it. But it wasn't just a matter of opinion. A lot of it was a matter of fact.
Well, and, but it's not limited to the hills either.
Yeah,
it happens the world over, and that's why there is a human, more of a human ban on it than anything else. Again, with the exception of royalty.
Right. But don't you feel that the penalty, one of the penalties are, that the physical appearance and impurities in the of even the very appearance of them are different. I know one that there was that type of action took place in the family. His teeth look like still baby teeth, and he's mentally impaired to a certain degree. I certainly hope he's not listening.
And yet, funny, oddly enough, where something like incest is concerned, the law against it doesn't prevent it. It only punishes it when it's found.
Yeah. Well, that's what law's all about, you know. That's what speeding's all about, you know. They make these high-powered cars, give you all the whiskey you can drink, get you for drunk driving. But what about the cure for it? What are they going to do about the actual cure for these things?
Some of these things, they're not. Well, it's like child molesters. There is no cure for child molestation. You can't make a child molester stop wanting to molest children.
No. And you know what? That I don't know what the heck they'll finally do about the prison system, the way it grows. But, and I, Bob, I've always been against the death penalty until here lately, but because it was the blacks and the poor whites that got the real blunt of the stiffest penalties, and that's the death penalty. But with this, these rapes, and, you know, to do a woman like that, or to molest a child, should be the ultimate. But yet they'll put you in jail for 40 years for a damn bank holdup without, because the guy says he's got a gun in his pocket. That's capital. You're interfering with capital and commerce. But they'll turn right around and let and give these people 4 or 5 years and turn them out loose to do it again. And that I don't know. Maybe I'm the oddball, or maybe I'm just too hung up on this. I don't know, but it seems like to me that the only way you stop a rapist, especially when he's got when they catch him, he's got a track record of committing these assaults numerous times. And I'm not for keeping them. You know, we let them get away with this stuff and then pay them. You know, we keep them. They've got better medical. They got a national health bill, so to speak. The food is brought to them. Instead, they should take their hind end and string them up somewhere. I'm just absolutely, I'm for the death penalty now. And you know, you could have, we could have come to.
Well, I'm not. I will never be a death penalty proponent. Because I yearn for the day when humanity, reaches toward humanity and civilization. And, you know, granted, this is very Old Testament stuff, this whole eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth stuff. But that's the thinking of people from 3,000 years ago who weren't exactly the sharpest knives in the drawer.
Well, what are we going to do with these people? I mean, they get right back out and do the same thing over again.
Right. Don't let them out. You know, we have a prison population problem in this country, Ed, but it's not because we've got all the pedophiles and all the rapists in prison.
No, we
don't. It's because we waste our prison space on nonviolent offenders.
Right. Or a package of marijuana, or somebody that walks in and says, I've got a knife in my pocket, give me your money. Why, you know, I guess maybe it's because I would take a different approach to giving the money, but, still, yes.
Yeah, give them the money wrapped in a .45 caliber slug, sure.
Yeah, or a right hook, one or the other. You know, they'd have to show me that knife.
But that's a
broken bottle of some kind.
That's a cultural failing of ours. And, of course, once again, since this is Wednesday, a lot of the stuff with regard to so-called drugs is driven by the religion industry.
Mm-hmm.
That you know as well as I do, they always taught in the Southern Baptist Church where I grew up that, well, I mean, heavens to Betsy, we'd have communion. No, we didn't call it communion. We called it the Lord's Supper. And they served grape juice. And they told us this made up fable about how, well, when it says wine in the Bible, it really doesn't mean wine.
It means grape juice. Right. I know.
So they're literal, you know, they're literalists when they want to be literalists, and they'll make it up as they go along when they want to.
Yeah. Well, it's like
because for grape juice to mean grape juice in the Bible means that they had to have refrigeration that nobody talked about, or canning, neither of which was available.
Well, I knew that that had to be an alcoholic drink when they were discussing it, you know, I could get that.
Well, Jesus' first miracle at Cana, he turned
the
water into wine, and if he's just turning it into grape juice, why was there much rejoicing?
I would like to hear more of what you know, and I'm sure a lot of people would, but a lot of people are really turned off by the truth, you know.
Well, there's no fundies listening to this program, so we're safe. We've got rational people who listen to this program, and there are thousands.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is, you know, it's like our buddy Larry started the program by saying, I want everybody to read the Christmas story. Read the account of it in Matthew and Mark and Luke, and guess what? They're not the same stories. It's like they're describing three separate births.
Well, I can disprove Christmas with just one little thing. Number one, they said the shepherds were the end of the field tending their sheep, and we celebrate Christmas in December. That place over there was worse than our winters are here. So they had their sheep and so forth in by the 1st of November or through October.
Right,
so they weren't in the fields at that time that when they say that the three kings or however how many, I can't even remember, it's been so long since I did teach Sunday school.
Well, but, you know, and the other way, look, there's a reason they do it, it was named in December. You're absolutely, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you want to try to establish a calendar date for the birth of this Yeshua, this son of this carpenter in Nazareth, then it's clear that it happens in spring. Other people have spent more time on it than we have. But the fact of the matter is, every culture, Ed, respects, because if you don't, your culture dies out, the changing of the seasons and the movement of the year and the rising and setting of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And the winter solstice has always been a holiday. It was a holiday among the Celts, the Greeks, the Romans, the Hebrews, the Egyptians, the Mayans, the Mexica, the Sioux, the mound builder culture, the Chinese, the Lao, the Khmer, the Hindus, the Aryans, the Persians. Everybody has solstice festivals because it determines the rhythms of one's life. And so you had big pagan holidays around the solstice, and the early, Roman Catholic Church, or the early church said, you know, we got to replace these pagan holidays. Well, let's say that Jesus was born then, and we'll have a big mass and tell people they can still throw a big party, but they have to do it for Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find, you know, usually after I read something, it might not fall on me what I read for a month later.
Well, I tell you what, Ed, if you want to find the other story, I told you that Abraham pimped his wife out twice. Abraham in Egypt is covered in Genesis 12, chapter 10 through 20. And I know there are people that think this is just silliness, but, you know, we have to arm ourselves with this stuff so that we can fight back against these ignorant fundies.
Yeah.
But if you look in Genesis 12, chapter 10 through 20, you'll find that, and it's not like what happened with Abimelech. Abimelech wised up and said, yeah, you know, and whether he had a dream or God sent him a billboard or an email or whatever, Pharaoh didn't wise up. And it says that Pharaoh's officials saw Sarah and they sang her praises to Pharaoh. You can just imagine what that kind of talk was. Boy talk is boy talk in any language.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she looks like a stacked ziggurat. You know what I mean? And so Pharaoh treated Abram well because of her, and he received, and look, it's a shakedown, flocks of oxen and donkeys and men and women slaves and she donkeys and camels. You know what? You don't give that to a guy because his sisters come for dinner.
Right.
And then it admits it in the book that Pharaoh did the nasty with her, because Yahweh inflicted severe plagues on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife Sarah. So Pharaoh summoned Abram and said, "What is this you've done to me? Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why'd you say she's my sister so that I took her for my wife?
Yeah.
When Pharaoh marries you, there's a honeymoon night.
Mm-hmm.
Abram literally pimped out his wife.
Yeah.
And I'm supposed to think that that guy's holy and that he had a special relationship with God?
It's hard to go to church nowadays knowing the difference like you do. It's hard to sit under the type of teaching that goes on. And to me, it's still the simplest form that I try to apply to my life is believe on him and you shall be saved, and all this other stuff can be eliminated.
Well, I take it even a step further. Do to other people as you want to be done to you. Be good to the poor, clothe the naked, house the homeless. In other words, decent human conduct. And he said, you do that to them, and you've done that to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it tells you, you know, you visited me not when I was in prison. You did this, and you didn't do that. And
love thy neighbor as thyself. That is the law and the prophets.
Sometimes that's hard to do. I apply that to myself because I have some pretty stiff enemies, two or three, and it tells me to be at peace with everybody as much as is within me. And if it wasn't for that, I know I wouldn't have a chance because I am not able to get past some of the stuff that happens.
Well, I didn't say it was easy. Just said to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's lines in there about my yoke is light, and I guess it's light in terms of, you know, you're not going to get whipped for this or it doesn't cost you anything, but the work is, you know, and I've heard preachers in the pulpit, being a Christian is easy. All you have to do is believe. Well, that's Tinkerbell religion. That's Tinkerbell Christianity. It takes, there's Plato writing 500 years before Christ. He says the unexamined life is not worth living, and that's what Jesus is saying too.
Well, I've always thought that what do we need a brain for if everything's all that simple? You know, why did we get a brain and not be able to question?
Well, he said have the faith of a little child, not the brain of one.
Yeah.
Well, Ed, I appreciate it, and I hope you have yourself a great evening. You want to finish off? Let me put you on hold?
Sure.
All right, we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thank you for the education.
Oh, it ain't no education on my part. It's a discussion. We're educating each other. Stand by.
All right, thank you.
Uh-huh. And rolling on here. The emails, our pal Kate writes in. She says, you know, I got kicked out of Sunday school for asking the Sunday school teacher why was there a lamb in the winter. Yeah. Religion does not, very few of them admit of questions. And again, that's one of the things that I do revere about, you know, the things that I've learned from folks like Mark and Betsy is that their whole faith seems centered on questioning. There aren't a lot of religions that do that. And I gotta have some respect for that. Catching up, by the way, our buddy Marty says, that the guy that Dave and I were trying to remember was Percy Schmeiser. And Percy Schmeiser was the guy who got run off his farm by one of the agri giants who sued him into submission that Dave and I were discussing. Marty also sent along a little food for thought. And we should probably be doing a lot of news, but dadgummit, it's Wednesday, and we're going to do some of this, and we haven't spent 3 hours on just straight-up religiosity in a while, and it is that season. And I'm not kidding. Know thine enemy. You gotta know how these people think if you are going to do battle against them. You do not take a knife to a gunfight. And you can't just look at them and say, well, you're a fundamentalist idiot. You have to be able to take the starch out of them. But Marty sends in a little piece of information. Useless trivia. Guess whose new salary is approximately $10,905.13 an hour? Dang, good money if you can get it. $10,905.13 an hour. He says, why, that's the new wage of apparent New York Yankees lefty C.C. Sabathia. Dividing 160 million. Now, you want to talk about pornography? Paying a human being $160 million to throw a baseball, no matter how well he throws it. $160 million divided by 7 yields $22,857,142.86 per year. It's a 7-year contract. And dividing that by the 2,096 work hours, which he will put in, yields $10,905.13 an hour. How's that for some math? Marty says, I guess this will start taking the heat off of CEOs. But not those overpaid UAW workers at GM. Yeah. Let's... The imaginary $70 an hour. The phonied up, dummied up, ginned up, rubed up, faked up $70 an hour that working Americans make. But $10,905.13 per hour? Shh. Let's not talk about that, or else we'll start thinking we've got a really, really screwed up society. Okay? And keep it rolling. Hey, welcome to the program. Hey, Juanita.
Hey, can I get in on the conversation?
You jump right in.
I'm a woman.
That's okay. You count here. You just don't count in the Bible.
I wanted to say something about Sheila.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, in those countries, I mean, you know, I've met people, a lot of doctors, like from India and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a lot of what we call girl names, like Karen.
Oh, I know. I was just funning, Juanita.
I know. Karen and Lucille.
It's just the idea of that poor woman Tamar having to wait for Sheila to decide he wanted a wife.
But I did meet, I used to work, supposed to work with migrant workers, and I did work with some of them, but some of them were just people that were what they considered poverty, the Department of Agriculture. And I met a man named Lois.
Mm-hmm.
He was probably Scotch-Irish or something like that. But his mother had other boys, and she said she just couldn't think of a boy's name, so she named him Lois.
Other names, Evelyn, what you and I would pronounce as Evelyn.
Yeah.
One of my favorite English writers, Evelyn Waugh. Sure.
Oh, and that's that a man?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay.
and let's see. I've got a local state senator.
How about
Joyce Kilmer.
Joyce Kilmer.
And I've got a local state senator named Shirley.
Uh huh.
So yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of I think a lot of names that used to be like boys' names, or they're naming girls now.
Oh, Taylor and Morgan and...
Yeah. Ashley, Ashford, I mean...
Ashton.
You get used to it, though.
Well, you know, and that's something we seldom think about. We give names their own individual reality, Juanita, but they used to mean something. I mean, we're having fun with Genesis this evening. Every now and then I'll say, for instance, when Rebecca's last child is born and she drops dead, before she dies, she names the child Benoni.
Yeah.
And Benoni, you're told in the footnotes that Benoni, you're told in the actual body of the text that Benoni means child of my sorrow. And how sad.
Child of what?
Child of my sorrow.
Of her thoughts?
Of my sorrow.
Oh, of her sorrow. Okay.
Yeah, because she was dying and wouldn't be able to see the little fella grow up.
And you talk about romantic love now. That was romantic love. He worked for 7 years because he thought he was going to get her, but he got Leah.
Yeah.
And
yeah, because Laban pulled a shifty on him.
Yeah. Well, he got back a lot of what he'd done to his brother. But then he worked another 7 years for Rebecca. But you know what is interesting to me in that is the back and forth in Genesis of them trying to get him to sleep with them, and they would even give him their, handmaidens, you know, too.
Oh, yeah, because there's
because
also...
they were trying to outbeat, but Leah was the winner, you know. She had the most.
Right, and then they give their handmaidens to Jacob to try to make up for the... Oh, who were those? Who were the handmaidens? I can't remember now.
I don't remember the handmaidens. But it is fascinating.
Isn't that some fine, upstanding, traditional family marriage they got going on there with Jacob and Leah and Rebecca?
Some could say the blind leading the blind, and some could say deliberately misleading, and I think a lot of it's deliberate.
It absolutely is. I've got the sons of Jacob right here, and who had him? Oh, Zilpah was one of them.
Yeah.
Bilhah was Rachel's slave girl, and Zilpah was Leah's slave girl.
Yeah.
Because Zilpah gave birth to Gad and Asher, and Bilhah gave birth to Dan and Naphtali.
Dan and who?
Naphtali. So, you can't exactly say that those were consensual pregnancies now, can you? Because when you're a slave girl and somebody says, go get it on with my husband, you don't get to say no.
No, of course not. But it was a real rivalry.
Oh, yes, it was. Yes, it was.
Very much so. And, you know, Joseph was her firstborn, Rebecca's, and that was his favorite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we had some real family values going on there with how they treated him too, didn't they?
Oh yeah, but he went out and bragged about.
Yeah, he rubbed their noses in it, sitting there.
Yeah.
You know, they're sitting around chewing.
And he didn't have to go out and work like they did.
No, but when they are sitting around in the field, he tells them, "Hey guys, hey brothers, I had a dream last night, and you were all bowing down to me." And they're the ones who are actually doing the work. And that's, Lord, how does that not get under your skin?
Right, right.
But then the Bible can't even tell you the same story twice because it tells you two different stories of how they got rid of Joseph.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
How was that?
Well,
I don't remember that.
Oh, gosh, it's, here, I'm thumbing around.
I know they sold him into slavery after putting him in a...
Oh, yeah, they did, but, let's see. There are two different versions, and they are in Genesis chapter 37, and it happens between Genesis 12 and 35. The footnote here says it will be noticed that two different versions of the story are combined in this chapter. In one, Joseph's brothers are for killing him, but Reuben, hoping to rescue him later, persuades them to abandon him in a well instead, and Midianite traders extricate him and take him to Egypt. According to the second story, Joseph's brothers are for killing him, but Judah suggests selling him to a party of Ishmaelites on their way to Egypt.
Oh, I have to check that out.
Yeah, because they don't match. Most of the Bible doesn't match.
The thing is, like, with the... In Genesis, the story of the creation.
Yeah, two different stories of that.
Yeah, actually, and a lot of churches do teach that, you know, and some don't. I know the first church that I ever knew that taught that was Christian Scientist, and I got heavily involved in that. And I was, I would tell people, there was two stories of the creation. Oh, no.
Heresy, burn the heretic.
Yeah. It has sense enough to.
Well, but see, the reason this happened is that by the time it got written down, there were all kinds of competing oral traditions. And so when stories get passed down orally with no way of creating a written record, things get a little bit mixed up.
But my daddy, and he was a really strong Christian, but he made people mad when he said the Bible contradicted itself because he was really read it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just got an email rolling in from Kate. She says, sleep. All this sleeping going on. Why didn't they call it sex? No wonder the religious freaks are so uptight. All they did is sleep. If they'd had some sex, maybe they could say the word.
They also knew one another, too.
Oh, yeah, and Adam knew Eve, and yeah. That's the nice thing about this translation. We get rid of all that Elizabethan knowing.
Now, what is that translation?
It's called the Jerusalem Bible.
Yeah, well, who did it?
It was literally a team of scholars. For instance, the book of Job was translated by none other than J.R.R. Tolkien. You know, the guy who wrote The Lord of the Rings.
Wrote what?
The Lord of the Rings.
Oh, okay.
Very famous author.
But don't worry, there's
no hobbits or elves or anything in Job.
It's
translated with relatively decent language and a pretty firm commitment to scholarship.
I have a Bible that has been translated by Jewish rabbis. Well,
it's mostly their book. You got to figure they've got a sort of a proprietary right to it. But I'm fairly comfortable with this translation.
Yes, that's why I was wondering. Maybe it was similar.
Yeah, well, I love the Elizabethan English and the thee-in and the thou-in, but there was a lot lost in because James the First of England had a vested interest in making sure that the Bible he put out put forward the message that he wanted told. So it gets screwed up and messed up and cleaned up quite considerably. And you wind up with translations of things like peace on earth, goodwill toward men,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't say that.
I wanted to say something about the story about the sword.
Yeah.
Jesus and the sword.
Mm-hmm.
I think I heard that gentleman talking about it before. And this is a great puzzlement to me, this story. Because, you talk about contradictions, I don't know how, does the Jerusalem Bible, does it have the New Testament?
Oh, yes.
Okay. You read it, and he tells them, you know, to sell and get a sword, and then Peter said he had a sword, and somebody else had a sword, and so Jesus said, that's enough. You know? And then...
Well, that's another one of those moments where we don't get everything that was probably said, because I read the New Testament, Juanita, and I just think that there's got to be a lot of parts in there where if there's any truth to it at all,
I understand it because I don't.
Well, I got to think that there's a lot of part. I mean, you can read it, you can see it in the text. I've mentioned a couple of them, a lot of places where Jesus just puts his head in his hands and he sort of rubs his temples with that Excedrin headache number 962 with these clowns that don't understand anything he's talking about.
Well,
what
I wanted to say about that was then when Jesus is arrested, there's one book that says that Peter took the sword and clipped one of them's ear off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and Jesus said, put up thy sword, Peter. He who lives by the sword shall die by the sword. And he healed the man's ear. Well, I thought, well, now why did he tell them and have them by the sword and then turn around and say, if you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword?
Well, that makes a little bit of sense considering a later passage. When we all know about Peter denying Jesus three times. Well, that happens after the whole business with the sword. Again, assuming that all of this actually happened and isn't just a bunch of made up stuff. When you hear it taught in a typical fundamentalist church, Peter's just sort of lost and wandering around. And, hey, aren't you Peter? Aren't you one of those? Aren't you one of Jesus' buddies?
Uh huh.
Oh no, never heard of the guy. When in fact, the guy has just committed an assault on a Roman soldier.
Yeah.
Which was, it was a crucifying offense, if you want to get right down to it. So it wasn't about, you know, him just trying to make you, no, I don't know the guy. It was the fact that there was probably a manhunt on for Peter. And, you know, he was, aren't you Peter? Weren't you one of them? Oh, no, that's my cousin. No, that's never heard of.
You know,
I don't know that
maybe,
Jesus.
I used to.
He was trying to evade responsibility for committing a criminal assault.
Well, to me, like I think Peter, you talk about laughing. I mean, you read a lot of the Bible is hilarious to me, and you know, it's just so human. And you know, in like our foibles, it's just like we are. I mean,
well, look, you know, one of the
changes.
Look at the frustration. You can hear the frustration just coming out. When they've got that ointment and his feet are being anointed, and I get, is it tradition or does the book actually say that Judas says we need to sell this and give the money to the poor? Yeah, which is basically what Jesus has been saying all along.
Yeah.
And Jesus just looks up and says, "Oh me," and I mean you can hear his head hurting.
Well, you know,
and he says, "You know, the poor. Look, the poor you've got always with you."
You know, the thing is that with Jesus, if you ever been misunderstood, you like you're the only one, like us the liberals, you know. A lot of people misunderstand us. I can imagine just a little bit of the frustration that he felt.
Well, and see, because he was very much an intelligent individual.
Yeah,
and
he read the book, you know, he read in the.
Well, that's the question I've got. One assumes that he could read in Hebrew.
Well, he did. Oh, I don't know, but he read, you know, he read that in, you know, that what he came to do. He came to heal the brokenhearted, to set at liberty those that were captive, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But there's a question. There's a question as to, you know, what he did and didn't know. But you know, there's so much of this. For instance, if you start on one end of the Gospels and go to the end, it takes the transaction with Judas at the Passover. It takes it as being a simple transactional event that's not at all clear what the outcome was. And by the time you get all the way to John, the Judas is doing everything but having his head go 360 degrees around because he is of the devil and he's been possessed by the devil.
Yeah.
Well, John, whoever wrote John probably never even met Jesus.
Well, according to the book, he did. He was the one that wrote it.
John would have been dead by then.
Not then, he wasn't.
No, when John was first written, John had to have been dead.
Well, some think he's never died.
John?
Yeah. Because when Jesus kept telling Peter to feed my sheep, you know, after he was risen from the grave, and he said, "You love me," and he asked him three times, and he said, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you." And then he turns around and he looks at John. That's according to what's written. He looks at John and says, "Well, Lord, what's he going to do?" And Jesus said, "Watch. What is it to you if he should tarry till I come?" And a lot of people think that, well, John.
Yeah, but that's reading stuff. I'm talking about the actual textual origins of the books.
Well, I don't know all of that.
Well, and that's the thing. The earliest books in the New Testament, Juanita, are the letters of Paul. Okay? They're not the Gospels. The earliest of the Gospels was written no earlier than 30 years after the crucifixion. John was written at about 125 A.D. or thereabouts. The author of John, the guy who actually put the words down on paper, the author of John never even got within swinging distance of meeting Jesus. And that's why the biblical scholars separate Matthew, Mark, and Luke from John. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are called the synoptic gospels. In other words, they all come from the same point of view or the same original document, which biblical scholars refer to as Q.
Whoever wrote John, that's a beautiful book, though.
It is, but it's got a lot more magic and gizmos and miraculous stuff in it, as opposed
to I believe in miracles because I am one.
and we all are. I mean, I'm
well,
one great big. I've found out that I'm one great big walking birth defect. Then I'm. At least for the
but
time
I know
being,
that
still
I
here.
Am, you know, because I know what I've been brought from, what I've been brought out of.
But the probably the most accurate of all the books about Jesus is the one that the church never allowed to come in, and that is Thomas. And if you want to look it up online, you can.
I've got it. I've got it bookmarked.
That's all just sayings of Jesus. There's no narrative in there. It's just all stuff that he said. Or is said to have said.
I haven't read it all. I mean,
well, it's confusing and it's enigmatic and it's in perfect line with with a lot of schools of thought that where you don't just lay it out, you make people think for themselves. Juanita, I've run up against it, and I got to try to work in one more phone call, but this sure has been fun.
You take care.
All right, bye now.
Night.
And thank all of you for this little conversation we've had in the cathedral tonight. The Cathedral of Common Sense. Let's see. Hey, welcome to the program.
Richard.
Hey, Richard, what's up?
I forgot.
Sorry. If I had a staff.
Huh?
If I had a staff,
Oh, yeah, your producer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was, I listened to you in delay, and my mind is still on last Friday. And now I've forgotten what you said.
Oh, that could be tough because I don't necessarily know what I said last Friday.
I know. But yet it allows me to listen to the entire show, which is kind of interesting. You know, follow the thread from the first minute to the last.
Yes.
Yeah, but I was going to talk about car designs, but it's too late. Not enough time.
Okay, well, we will try to wedge in the discussion on another day then. I'm sorry, but... these things happen this way. I don't know. One of these days when we're millionaires, we'll have screeners and engineers and all kinds of people just buzzing around here, and we'll do it all professional-like.
Okay.
All right.
Later.
Richard, take care. Bye now. So that's it. I hope I haven't bored you. I'm sure that there are some people who are just driven absolutely batty by this stuff. But it's kind of what we reserve Wednesdays for. And I hope you've been able to tolerate it. I agree with Larry at the beginning of the program. You got to study this stuff because otherwise, and he didn't say it, it's worth knowing just to see all the contradictions and to see all the stuff that doesn't make any sense. And now, based on what we went over, you understand why it was that the guy who replaced Jeremiah Wright at Trinity United Church of Christ, you understand why he said Abraham was a pimp. And, of course, the right wing and the O'Reillys of the world went absolutely out of their minds. But he was. He was. And the whole book is like a police blotter of criminal conduct that you wouldn't tolerate in your own neighborhood, let alone your own home. It just is. But Abraham's a prophet, and peace be upon him. Maybe he's a profitable pimp. But anyway, thanks. And thanks, of course, to everyone who makes the program go, from News Ninjas to our moderators in the chat room. Come by the chat room if you've never been by there before. It's a lot of fun. To the folks who blog. Thanks to John Fox and Peter Godbold and Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org who makes all the streams go. Thanks to the bravest, hardest working people I know, the folks at Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColdRiverWind.org. Look at what they do, and you'll know why I say what I do. Thank you to those of you who have stepped up again this month to try to keep this going. if there are more of you, any of you, who can participate, who don't or haven't, this would be a great time to do it. It's getting mighty, mighty difficult to keep the lights on. Just, it is. So we'll catch you tomorrow evening. Guy James will be a rerun tomorrow because he's got jury duty. Mark Levine will be here. Then I will be here. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
Now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Calling back. Hello. Calling back. Hello.
Calling go, Mark. Back. Hello. Go, Mark. Go, Mark. Go.
welcome to the Inside Scoop, everyone. I'm sorry we had a bit of a computer malfunction there, but all is good, and I got a lot to talk about. First thing I want to discuss is what the heck is going on in Chicago. Perhaps I should say what the bleep is going on in Chicago. That seems to be the word of choice. That's the one used by Governor Blagojevich. And, of course, quoted by the U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald. What is going on in Chicago? Well, Chicago has an interesting history, of course. It is actually, I probably should broaden that to Illinois. In the last eight governors of Illinois, four have gone to prison. That's pretty good, right? That's 50%. Four have gone to prison, including the guy just before Governor Blagojevich, Governor Ryan. So what is up with this state? Well, it seems to be that paying to play, as they call it, bribery would be another name for it, is simply common culture in Chicago. And it's not just a question of what goes on in the governor's office. We also have Sam Zell, the owner of the Chicago Tribune, fire all his employees, actually doing a trick deal in order to steal from them all their value, all their pensions. And then you've got, you have union troubles, of course, specifically their employer troubles, that Republic Windows and Doors also trying to lock out their workers. So there's a lot going on in the corrupt state of Illinois, and maybe some of you in the Chicago area can help me out with trying to understand what's really going on here. I want to report on that. I also want to report something that Bob Kincaid told me about that's on my website, and that is the wonderful statement of Pat Boone. Now, I fully admit that I don't know that I've ever heard a Pat Boone song. I'm very proud of that. I don't think he has much talent. But I did not know that he was running for Grand Wizard of the KKK. Apparently he is. Apparently Pat Boone had decided that to go down as a, you know, two-bit singer was not enough for him. He wanted to go down as a minister of hate. So Pat Boone, get this, compared the terrorist attacks in Mumbai, those vicious, horrific attacks that killed so many innocent people, it's hard to have a dry eye, frankly, when you if you watch those attacks, thinking about the innocent people hiding under tables, running away for their lives. If you think about the Jewish center where the Indian population is, what, 0.0001% Jewish? There's maybe 1,000 in 1 billion people. What is that? That's 1 in 1,000,000, 0.00001%. And yet they sought to kill them.